My name's Long John Neville.
I'm Candy Jones.
And tonight we're going to be talking with Gene Shepard, well-known humorist, broadcaster, actor, and author of several books and screenplays and numerous articles. And his book that we talked about some time ago, when it was in hardcover, is now in paperback, and it's titled Wanda Hickey's Night of Golden Memories and Other Disasters. It's just been published in paperback by Dell Books. Well, Mr. Shepard, we're delighted to have you here tonight.
Delighted to be here, Mr. Neville, Miss Jones.
How do you do?
I mean, I like John's. He always comes on with that patent of formalism, which gives a certain style to life.
You know, I've never seen Gene before.
Really?
No, I've been a fan.
Disappointing, isn't it, though?
Yeah.
You'd figure he would be a handsome... A man,
evil,
young.
Yeah, evil he is. Evil sort of look. From the left side, I'm viewing him three-quarters left.
He's viewing me from the left side, fourth side.
That's right.
That's right.
Well, I'm glad to be here, John. You're looking great.
I'm feeling marvelous. And how are all of the people over at the zoo?
Which zoo? I'm involved in so many zoos, I couldn't tell you. Remember, I'm an associate editor of Playboy, too.
That's right.
I've seen plenty of zoos in my time.
That's right. We were in Cheers last night, and for a moment it was very dark where the gentleman was sitting at the end of the bar, and I didn't realize it was Herb Salzman until after I got into the car. Man said, "Hi, John, how are you?" And I said, "Hi, how are you? Nice to see you." And I didn't realize it was the great Herb Salzman.
You mean that mustache got you?
Yeah.
Well, that just clips on, you know, on his nose. That's not...
He just uses it for bar sitting?
That's right. When he's in the neighborhood there.
But he really is the top maven over there. Top dog.
Do I write that as a personal attack?
Yes.
But he gets equal time.
We'll have to give him equal time at some time.
No, Herb's a good guy. He's one of those unusual program heads, chiefs of radio stations. He is
the head man there.
You bet he is. He walks a quiet step down the hall now, though.
And George Brown is what?
George's the vice president. He's in charge of all news for all of RKO General. That's nationwide.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a great empire, you know, that news they have over there.
Yes.
So he's doing well.
And then we have Mr. Farber.
Mr. Farber is on the air 4,922 hours a week.
That's right.
At least. And I see Barry occasionally looking harassed in the elevator. He comes popping out. He always reminds me of the jolly green giant that went down and got a suit at Robert Hall. He comes popping out looking frantic. Half the time he says, "Hello, hello," you know, and he grabs your hand, and then about 30 seconds later throws into his head who he's talking to. Good old Barry.
Is he still counting his money?
I don't know. Barry plays a close hand, as W.C. Fields used to say.
Well,
he plays a close hand, and it's hard to know.
Yes, it is rather difficult.
I think he's doing well, though, John.
I know he has two penthouses.
Yes, he has.
And so things are going evidently extremely well for him.
Swimmingly.
That's right. I know that foundation that he set up, the Barry Farber Foundation for Wife and Children. I thought it was very good, and I know that he'll help many people with that money.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm.
I have not had the opportunity of seeing him for a long time. Did you want to? Oh, you have coffee.
I have coffee, yes. This is a typical radio station coffee.
What do you mean?
It's what my assistant, Lee Brown, calls rat coffee.
Oh, no,
Oh, wait a minute, Candy. It's perfect for drinking out of paper cups.
These are not paper cups. These are all ceramic lines.
Yeah, I see that. No, it's good.
There's just a little left over from Barry Gray's show. I always take the remains from his show
because
and mix them with
You know what I mean?
You're doing a Tyler's-like coffee that I can chew. Just give me something to bite on here.
You know, I was just the other day talking to somebody. Oh, I know who it was. It was to one of our spiritual leaders here, Cliff Barrett, our program director. Mm. And he had asked me how, you know, I had started at WR, and I was telling him the story of driving out the first night to the transmitter after you were relieved of your duties at about 2 o'clock in the morning. And I went out the next night, and it was very stimulating to have that opportunity of being around with some of the great engineers in broadcasting. I didn't really meet them till about 4 or 5 in the morning when they were awakened.
You know, it was a very interesting time, although I don't think a lot of people at the time, just like any time, you don't have as much of a sense of perspective. But I think that was the period of all the beginning of a lot of the demonstrations in the country and hip humor. For those of you who are listening, Mr. Neville is now posing for what looks like a Gilbert Stuart portrait. He's doing his American Gothic face, which he learned on the south side of Chicago.
That's quite true. And in a moment, I'm going to tell this young man about the merits of old world old teeth.
You have that look, John.
We have him on his knees already.
That's right.
John is going to come back in another life. He's going to come back as a lady wearing tennis shoes and wearing a Barry Goldwater T-shirt and loving cats.
And Miller for vice president.
You know, it's funny about John. John is one of the few guys I know who can get a tremor of true emotion in his voice when he's describing a million tiny invisible fingers moving up and down your back.
gently kneading
your spine.
In every muscle in your body.
And every ganglia is vibrating with excitement. And he says, these aren't like those pillows with a buzzer in them.
I always wonder, I'd love to get one of those pillows with a buzzer in them. This is not a vibrator.
Certainly is
a cyclo action.
Of course, it's like riding downhill in a barrel over Niagara Falls.
You know what I think about you?
Yeah, Candy.
I always
don't say that on the air. We're on the air.
We're off the air. You can tell them the truth.
For some reason, I always associate you with wax teeth.
Wax teeth?
Yeah. Orphan Annie, Little Orphan Annie, Secret Society. And I think we sort of go back to the same time in the 30s. And I read a book of yours one time in which you had said something about your Orphan Annie Secret Society ring. And I think you may have been wrong, or maybe there were two of them. It seems that I was green for years from wearing my Dick Tracy Dakota ring.
Well, you see, Candy, when I write or tell a story, I'm not recounting my own past. I have to break this to you gently.
This wasn't you?
No, I'm a storyteller, and a storyteller... No, I have to be honest with you that a lot of people listen to me, and they hear the fact that I use the first person, and they assume that what I'm doing is telling about me.
Mm-hmm.
It's a reasonable assumption. But actually, I work as a comic, really, in the same way that, say, Bill Cosby does. And you hear Bill Cosby tell about stories of Fat Albert, and he says, I was playing around it. Now, he's not really being literal, that he's telling a story. And in fact, they even got into such a hassle one time on that show that they have to now say before his show, his fictional friends, Fat Albert.
Really?
Yeah, because there were people writing in all the time saying, look, I'm Fat Albert, and I don't like what you said about me last week. You'll notice that in all my work, for example, the book you're talking about, which is In God We Trust, All Others Say Cash. Well,
yeah.
In the beginning, I very clearly state that it's fictional. And that wasn't for legal purposes. It is fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's very disappointing.
Don't you know the wax teeth that she's
talking about? See, yeah, you see, you know, when you're a kid, you see, they're still around. See, one of the great myths in American life, Candy, And this is, I guess, the problem of growing up in America, because we tend to leave our hometowns when we grow up. We tend to move into different areas. Now, like here, you're living right in the middle of New York City, and I'm sure when you were a kid, you were living in a different area, different
coal mine.
Exactly. Okay. Well, What we do, when we grow up and leave that area, we tend to think all that stopped now. We tend to believe that since we're not there, it no longer exists. It's like a guy who, you know, thinks that there isn't Cracker Jack anymore because he's taken up scotch. And he's always shocked to see it's around yet. In fact, it's a funny thing, Candy. I constantly run into this, but the people who are adults who read a book, they tend to read it through their own eyes, of course, which is, again, natural.
But
no, you should read it. Yeah, but you should really read it more with an eye towards what the book's trying to say rather than your own involvement with it. And they tend to think that anybody who's read my work, from a kid of 9 years old to a person of 90, that I am specifically writing about his time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's right. Now, that's important to remember. What I'm saying here is that the things I write about, I'm very careful. I never specify any time in any of my work. I never say it was 1956 or 1942 or 1910 or 1918-90. But everybody who reads it says, well, it must be my time. Because the things that I write about are things which I think most writers never touch. And that's the day-by-day, almost continuing life of America. For example, just yesterday, I was in an office in Fort Lauderdale talking to a critic.
Yesterday?
Yes.
I mean, for real?
Just flew home this morning, yeah.
Uh-huh.
And I was talking to this critic who wanted to interview me about Wanda Hickey.
Gee, you'll go anywhere.
Well, I was down there on other business, but he called me. Anyway, the guy says, he's sitting in this office, and strangely enough, there were about 15 secretaries sitting around typing away, see? And they were all about 18 or 19, see? So he says, right to Dandy, he says, I don't quite understand this reference that you make here to something called a Twinkie. And I says, a Twinkie? You don't know what a Twinkie is? He says, well, isn't that some kind of an hors d'oeuvre or something like that? I says, my God, with that, all 19-year-old secretaries in the room flipped. And I says, how many of you have gone through a stage when you had a Twinkie hang up? You wanted to... And all of them laughed. And, of course, the point being here that right now there's a 9-year-old kid sneaking out into the kitchen somewhere over in Bergenfield trying to get the last banana Twinkie.
And it's true.
So there are things which in our life, American life, and I'm trying to do, in a sense, what Twain did, really, and I'm not certainly paralleling myself with him, but I'm trying to catalog the daily trials and tribulation of life of the average walking around resident of the 20th century, not a specific period in time.
You sound as though you are today's Mark Twain.
Well, that's a pretty broad statement, because...
You're a pretty broad man, aren't you?
No, go ahead.
Well,
Twain, I think Twain... The only parallel I would say is that we use boyhood as a medium, really.
Yeah. You both have sort of your Peck's bad boy syndrome, and you both have your fat kid, your Alfie, and your Butch, and the one who's always the loser, and the one who's always the winner, and the nice kid, and then there's always Aunt Polly. She's always
I think this is a natural, I suppose you might say, distribution of our species. You go right here into the therapy problem here at WMCA, and you're going to find your Alfie. You're going to find your loser. You're going to find your
Just a moment. No, when you're talking about our sales department, our spiritual leader happens to be Jerry Lewis. We have some of the finest salesmen in the entire nation associated with this station.
I'm sure.
And I'm proud of being a member of this group.
Of course. And, of course, within them, like all philosophers, I have to say, all present company exempted from any statements here tonight, that none of these things exist here. However, in other areas of life, you will find losers. You'll find winners.
Mm-hmm.
And the relationship between the two is always interesting because they coexist. Winners cannot exist without losers. No way. You cannot be a winner unless there's a loser. And, of course, on the other hand, some people enjoy losing. It's an exquisite thrill to lose. Oh, sure.
Are these the masochists of love?
Not at all. No.
What thrill would there be in losing?
Well, losing gives a person a sense of righteousness often. We have developed a curious, I suppose, say, attitude in America that losers by nature are sort of they're right. In other words, Billy the Kid has become a righteous person. The lawman who gets him is not. In short, the loser is often in America glorified. And so many people like the feeling of losing. It makes them feel as though somehow they had too much to offer. How many times have you heard people say, they weren't ready for it?
Sort of an Al Lockman.
They weren't ready for my truth.
You know, the worst
loser. No, those are the ones.
The worst loser.
Unfortunately, they were ready for it, and they caught it on the first bounce, and out he goes. Yeah, go ahead.
The worst loser is the one who comes in second, don't you think? I mean, that's the one I feel is sorry for. No,
well,
the last one.
He is. Second. He's a true loser.
Yeah.
A true loss is to see, just see flashing way ahead of you the glimmering golden shimmering rings of victory, and then to see somebody who looks a little like John Lindsay grab at the last instant and go off into the dusk.
On a white horse.
Well, you know, and there you are. Usually in an outboard motorboat with 115 horses.
And we are back here again. My name, Long John Neville.
I'm Candy Jones.
And we're talking with Gene Shepherd, and incidentally, his book is now in paperback, Wanda Hickey's Night of Golden Memories and Other Disasters. And Mr. Shepherd is four-time winner of the Playboy Humor Satire Award. And Gene and I have known each other now for about 20 years at that time. He was playing bass for East Side, wasn't it? What was the name of that show?
Drive East.
Drive
East. I really did play bass.
I know it.
Yeah.
I know it.
Incidentally, John, you know, I'm really excited. You know, both of us here are in the business, and it sort of sucks your life in, and you tend to live day by day in it. And I wonder how many people who are outside of the business that we're in, entertainment and performing and all, realize how every day that comes on, you never know what's about to happen.
Well, don't you think it's every other day that really counts when you have your contract renewed for another 48 hours?
See, I don't think it in terms of my show at all, because I guess this is the difference for me than most of other people that I know within this business, let's take radio, is that I'm never concerned whether my show is going to be renewed or anything like that, because I'm doing all these other things, and as a matter of fact, I wish someday I would wake up and magically all the radios disappeared, and I would start doing the things I should do, which is write more, perform more. Radio is kind of a soporific, at least in my world. In other words, it's a thing that comes very easily to me, and I really shouldn't do it.
Because it's easy to you?
Yeah. And also, it tends to keep me from doing what I should do. It takes a lot of time away, say, from my writing. Now, also my performing, you know, and I came to town, John remembers, I was doing a lot of acting, I performed in a lot of Broadway
Asylum
shows.
In particular.
Yeah, the Asylum, that's
that
right.
I remember, Marvel.
Yep, that's right. Did you see it?
Yes.
You're one of the people who did, too, because that
like
was...
Like a night, excuse me.
That was a brilliant piece of theater, it really was.
Arthur...
Culpit,
right.
He wrote Oh Dad, Poor Dad.
Mm-hmm.
It was done at the Theatre de Lise, and it was a production by it was Roger Stevens produced it. And that show had a curious history. We played for 4 weeks down there, and if you recall, I had the lead in the show, the curious role. And There were some fantastic people in the cast that were really, in a sense, fit players. For example, Sandy Baron.
Yeah.
He had just a walk-on in that show. Lenny Santoni, you know?
It was somebody else.
George Siegel,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. S. L. Parsons was in it.
That's right.
And
that was star-studded.
You better believe it. And you know, that was one of the great I suppose you'd call it tragedies in my career, because that never opened. It ran for 4 weeks in previews, and there was something came up with Mr. Copet, I believe, or somebody involved in the production, and decided the night before we would open not to open it. And it was a beautiful production.
We were there, not John, and I was there the second night, and I remember that there was a delay. I don't know why, but it was brilliant. It was
one of the
best things. And Martin Gottfried was in the audience, and he had missed the opening night. And Martin Gottfried is the drama critic from Women's Wear Daily.
Yeah.
And I remember he gave it a great write-up.
That's right.
And you in particular.
Well, I played a curious role in that, if you remember, Candy. I played an ex-Chicago White Sox third baseman.
It was weird.
Yeah, he was a third baseman, and he had played in Comiskey Park, by the way, John.
South Side.
Yeah, and he played against the Yankees, and one day in his rookie year, he was leading the league in hitting, the character, and he was, a pretty sensational rookie. And he got hit by a line drive. You recall the play?
Mm-hmm.
He got hit by a line drive. He played third base, and it ended his career instantly. And here he was now back, and he's in an asylum now. And nobody believes that he actually did this. Was the essence of the play.
He's very sad.
Yeah, they didn't believe it. He kept saying, well, look, all you have to do is read it in the records. Pick up the record book, and nobody would do it.
And they just thought he was a nut, automatically.
Yeah, because he...
What was that, about 64?
65. And I used to... This is getting back to radio now. I used to do a lot of acting, and I was very serious. And, well, this is serious theater. As you know, this was not small-time theater. I had done the Broadway revival of Voice of the Turtle. I played the sergeant in that.
Oh.
I did a couple of musicals. I did Destry.
You were in Destry?
Yeah. I played Destry. And I did a lot of...
In the original cast?
No, I came, it was revived, and I played it then.
Who was the girl, Gwen Burden?
No, Andy Griffith played Dolores Gray was the
original girl. Dolores Gray was the original girl, that's right.
And I did a lot of acting at that time. That was back in the mid-60s. And I'm sorry I didn't stick with it now. In fact, I think I may go back into it. Because I loved it. And it's really what I am. I'm a performer. When I'm on the air, I'm a performer. I'm playing a role on the air. I do different voices, John, and characters, and I set up scenes and all this. And I've developed almost, I suppose you could say, kind of a one-man epic theater or something. But
how long do you prepare? And do you prepare each night?
A show? Well, my preparing is very private. It's a private thing I do. The people who work with me, for example, Lee Brown has worked with me now for 10 years, and Lee doesn't know what I'm going to do the night I do it. But I will prepare a show in my head sometimes as long as a month when I think about it. And I always have 3 or 4 shows that I'm preparing in my head. I have little notes. As John knows, I have a desk that's just covered with stuff, but that I always know 3 or 4 ideas that I've got, germs of ideas for shows that I work on and prepare. Sometimes I may just do a show that I'll get an idea that afternoon and I'll do it, but that's rather unusual. Usually I prepare anywhere from 2 weeks to maybe 3 or 4 weeks on each show, although it doesn't sound that way.
Mm-hmm.
See,
that's the beauty of it.
Well, Candy, I've always felt, I'm a member of the Actors Studio. When I first came to town, I got on involved, as I said, in acting, and I'd gone to Goodman Theater, actress, a theater school in the Midwest. And I've been doing a lot of improvisational theater. And that kind of acting is a different kind of acting than Americans are used to. Oddly enough, it's the kind of acting Americans do best, too, which is, in a sense, an improvisational kind of acting upon a theme. Dustin Hoffman, for example, is an example of that. He may do a scene 7 different ways before they decide which one they're going to take.
Mm-hmm.
He's improvising, but within a very set limit. And so this is the kind of performing I do on the air. I also, my best evenings are when I'm performing on stage. I did, for example, last spring, I had a big success at Carnegie Hall. We had a sellout there. That's very unusual. In fact, the director, the manager of Carnegie Hall, said that we were the first single comedy act to sell out in a long time. And we sold out. And when I perform on stage, I perform, in the ideal situation, unless I'm playing a college, you can't do that, but in an ideal theatrical situation, I use lights, I use all kinds of area lighting. You remember the area lighting we had in
Asylum? Yeah. Beautiful. It was a really remarkable,
magnificent performance.
That could be brought back today, don't you think?
I think it was so far ahead of its time, I think they chickened out. I honestly think that was the reason they didn't open it. They were afraid, because it was truly avant-garde theater and beautifully done.
Yeah.
And, of course, that was back in the days when they were doing things like Virginia Woolf, which is very conventional compared to this. And it was a pretty wild piece of theater.
Yeah. Pioneers are losers many times.
That's correct. In fact, George Siegel, the night George and I are close friends, and the night that we were told that show was to open on a Saturday night, and on that Friday night, we had finished the performance, and Cheryl Crawford came backstage, and she just said it was fantastic, and you know who she is, of course, and. All the Actors Studio was coming down there to see it, and we went back to George's house. He has an apartment up on Central Park West, and I went back up to the apartment with George about 1 o'clock in the morning when the phone rang, and it was from the girl who was the production chief for Roger Stevens. And she got me on the phone. She says she knew I was up at George's place, and she says, Gene, she says, you better sit down. I said, what's up? She says, you'll never believe what happened. I said, what? She says, they've decided not to open the show. This was the night of the opening. And we had rehearsed it for 2 months. Very difficult piece of theater. And there's no feeling like that. And I guess this is what really kind of soured me on the theater, because I can't describe what an actor goes through preparing for a role like that. George and myself, we would work on that thing night after night in his house and on the street, and it was a fantastic emotional experience. And then to have somebody arbitrarily say, forget it.
Mm.
And we're sitting around in the apartment. George got up. I'll never forget it. George got up, and he looked down at the floor. Now, George had been in New York for about 8 years without even earning a living as an actor. He was really struggling. And he just walked around, and he walked over, and he kicked the sofa. They had a sofa there. He just kicked a hole right in that sofa. Just kicked it, and he sat down, and his wife came in, and she had coffee for him, and cream cheese, you know, or cheesecake. And she came in, and she looked at us, and she said, what happened? She didn't know what had happened to me. And George says, nothing. And she says, well, there's something happened here in this room. That's what's going on. George says, don't talk. Let's go out in the kitchen and leave us alone for a while. I mean, it was a fantastic shot. So with that, she walked out and went into the kitchen, and about 10 minutes later, we were sufficiently back in the world to realize what had happened.
And that following Monday, I got a call from Audrey Wood.
Fascinating call. Who was Arthur Copeland's agent, incidentally, also.
The voice of the trail.
Fantastic woman. She was, she's Tennessee Williams' agent, famous lady. And she called, I've never met her before, she called me up to her office, and she said, I just want to tell you, she said, how sorry I am about this. And she says, that was one of the most, she said, I want you to know that had that opened, you probably would have been the hottest actor on Broadway.
How much will it cost to bring that back, bring it in today?
That's a good question. That was an expensive production then, because it was, they had a special stage built. You recall, it was a canted stage.
Okay.
It was a canted stage.
I've never seen anything like that.
It was really quite a brilliant thing, John. And she went, you know, we've never talked about these things, John, you and I, and I'm glad we're talking about it. You know, it's one of those things I kind of buried in my past and never mentioned. But they went for curious authenticity so much in that production that they even went to the extent of calling the Chicago White Sox and getting an actual Chicago White Sox team warm-up jacket. And the White Sox contributed. Do you remember the jacket I had on the thing?
Yeah.
Curiously enough, that was a jacket. I got this jacket. It had been used, you know. It was actually used by the White Sox that earlier that season. And I got the thing, and I immediately knew whose jacket it was. You could smell it. It smelled like tobacco juice. And it was Nellie Fox, who's the second baseman for the White Sox. They had a two on the side, you know, big two on the back. And it was funny to take that jacket that you could smell that this guy had used this jacket for 2 years and had little piece. He was a famous tobacco chewer. Little bits of tobacco in the pockets, you know, this major league jacket, really. And I remember sitting on the stage one night, and we were in the middle of a scene. And George and I used to improvise a lot. That's why we got the role, because we were improvisational actors. George had been with the Premise. Remember the theater, a little theater group downtown? That there was an improv group, Theater Flickers group. Remember that?
Wasn't that Noel Baines?
No, Noel just managed the theater where they were. He didn't have the group. But anyway, that one night, George said to me, we're sitting there, see, and we started it. We actually went off the script. George is sitting there. He played a psychiatrist, you recall. Mm-hmm. And he's looking at me. See, and he would go into this phony accent, which was part of the thing. Remember, he said, "Well, I want to tell you." He said, "Well, that is a very interesting story." And he looks at me, and all of a sudden, he sniffs, and he can smell the tobacco juice. He says, "That is a very interesting jacket you are wearing." He says, "Is that nail polish you are chewing?" And the two of us improvised the entire scene about the kind of chewing tobacco that I chewed when I played ball in the play. And that was written into the script then. It was such a successful moment in the play when everybody started laughing because they could see this ball player chewing tobacco and spitting all over his jacket. And you know, I haven't talked about that production. It's been a long time, Candy. I'm glad you brought it up. You're one of the few people I've met who've seen it.
Well, I often wondered what had happened and why.
So did we.
Well,
this is wonderful. I'm glad you brought it up. I just feel good talking about it.
My name, Long John Neville.
And I'm Candy Jones.
And this is WMCA Dialogue Radio 57. Right here in New York City. And we're talking this morning with Gene Shepherd. And his book, which I personally recommend to you, is now available. It's published by Dell in paperback for $1.25. Wanda Hickey's Night of Golden Memories and Other Disasters. And Mr. Shepherd is four-time winner of the Playboy Humor and Satire Award. And Candy and I are talking to him. Just at the time when we had to take care of some business, which we're delighted to take care of business, You were going to say something, Gene.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, how are those horses out of Downingtown Inn?
Well, I'm not a horseman. Mr. Gray is an expert horseman.
Excellent rider.
Mr. Strauss is a horseman. And Candy.
Do they have good horses out there?
I don't know, but I did see the stable. I wasn't inside. We had a tour all around by Mr. Tavis, and the stable looked very good, and the few horses I saw.
Is there a good riding area around?
Oh, absolutely marvelous.
So they can keep the skiings
well. Well, the countryside is beautiful. It's slopy, and the bridle trails are beautiful, and it's you'd like it.
I like both, English and Western.
Yeah. Well, they have both.
Whatever's around, you know, if you have an Appaloosa, you ride Western. But I love
riding.
That's
strange that you ride both.
Why?
Well, most people I know, if you ride English, you ride English, period. But, you don't usually ride Western.
What do they do when they suddenly are given a quarter horse to ride?
I don't think that they ride.
Oh, I'm still sorry for them.
Well, probably, but it's an odd thing. I don't know why they don't, but I've known very few people who have ridden.
Well, I guess that's because I had a kind of an eclectic riding background, right? It's a great word. If you come from an unorthodox family, you'll learn to ride English, you know. Or if you come from some family in New Mexico or something, you'll ride Western. But I went with whatever happened to be going around at the time, and I learned what English riding I know from. I was, motivation is important in your life.
Yeah.
And there was one period in my life when I was really hung on this girl. And she was a fanatical rider. Mm-hmm. And I mean, a good one. In fact, she was so good. You remember when they had those camel ads? They had the T-zone. They said the X.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay? Well, she was that good that she was in one of those ads.
Oh.
She was a famous steeplechase rider. And I had
she
been faking. Yes, very good. And I had been faking it since. And so finally, the inevitable happened. One time, she got me out. She says, well, we've got to go riding. And I said, all right. And, all right. And I'll never forget that look of that horse. The horse turned around, gave me one look. And the horse is a fantastic extrasensory perception. And this horse instantly senses a person that he can master totally. And he turned around and just gave me that mean look in his eyes. She says, I can't understand what's the matter with him. He's usually recognized.
Your knees, and you know it.
That's right. It's the only horse I've ever ridden that as I rode him, he kept biting my knee. Incidentally, in full stride.
Lula Shepherd asked the question, and I can't answer it.
Yeah.
And I've never known myself. What is English?
Or what is English riding?
And what is Western?
Well, it's a very different kind of riding.
Is it a different saddle, too?
Yeah.
Yes. Different saddle, different seat.
And the gates are different?
The gates are different.
Oh, you mean the horse is different?
Yes. Yes.
The gates are
different. I thought you just changed the saddle.
Let's put it this way. English is very uncomfortable, and Western isn't.
Well, if you're in a McCallum saddle for too long a time, you can get awfully tired. I know that the old cowboys used to ride in them, and that's the saddle with the pommel up in the front. But
what do you call it?
McCallum.
No, I mean the thing.
The pommel.
It's a pommel.
But the English saddle, I always found far more comfortable, but I think it's all with which you start. I was brought up in an English saddle, but we had McCallum.
Well, I was a bareback rider, primarily.
Were you?
Yes.
Well, I think all kids do that.
Some people learn to ride bears pretty well.
That's a grizzly one.
Very good there. Captain, I didn't think I was feeding you a line, but I did accidentally.
Sneakier as time goes, but English riding, John, if you're asking a serious question, is more formal. And it's not working riding, really, in the sense that Western riding. Western riding is working riding. I suppose you can call it a riding for a work purpose.
What am I wearing?
Well, she's got the split English coat. Yeah.
Got a hacking jacket.
Hacking jacket, yeah, that's what I thought. I'd have to see the front, though. It is a hacking jacket, yeah, sure.
You wear it's a hacking jacket.
I don't know if you'd be interested in that, Chuck.
Well, go ahead, explain.
But one of the reasons is that if you notice the length of this jacket, now when you're just hacking around, and this is what the phrase hacking around comes
from. Hacking means just riding.
You're just riding.
You're just out riding for fun.
You're not riding for points, you're riding casually. So that the length of the jacket hides your backside, your rump on the seat, and you do not necessarily, you're not positioning or posting formally. You're not riding for, you're riding in a relaxed for enjoyment. So that a hacking jacket will always be longer and it will flap a bit on the seat.
It's a casual jacket for casual riding, English riding. And
whereas when you're showing, your jacket is going to be shorter because you'll be judged on points as to what your derriere is doing.
They judge your seat, as they call
your
it.
Your seat, right.
Yeah. Princess Anne is a fantastic rider.
I've seen films of her. She really is so great.
Yeah. They claim that if she wasn't a member of the royal family, she would really be an international rider, but it's, she is.
Highly competitive, isn't she?
Very. Yeah. She's got the look in the eye. Kathy Kusner, that type.
Did you know that Barry Gray is now a mounted policeman? Theatrical district?
No kidding.
Yes, looks absolutely magnificent in his uniform. And, of course, he is considered to be an outstanding
artist. Oh, he's a good writer, yes.
And so is our president.
How did he get this? Has he got the power of arrest?
Yes.
Well, Barry has been appointed.
He's an auxiliary mounted policeman.
Troop B.
He's a mounted trooper.
Yeah, yes. They have two or three. They have three troops, don't they? A, B, and C, or is it just two?
This I don't know, but Michael Burke, Vincent Sardi, Barry Gray.
Oh, very elegant.
A lot of people.
Very elegant.
And we saw him in his uniform. He went to remount school, and he's enjoying every minute of it. And he said,
you know, all right, I'll ask you a question now. You're a horseman. What kind of horses does the New York City Police use? Come on, what are they?
I know.
They're great horses.
I know, and I can't tell you.
And they're a specific breed.
Yes, they are, and I cannot tell you. I'm sorry.
Morgans.
Morgans.
Yeah. The Morgan is a New England horse, by the way, that was bred, I guess, just before the Revolution. It began by a man named Morgan. And they claim that... No, Paul Revere's horse was not a Morgan. What kind was it?
I wouldn't know.
Well, I'm going to leave
Paul Revere would have been in the 18th century.
This week, and we'll ask him.
That's right.
Well, this is, the Revolution was...
They know what type of horse he had. In other words, he had a specific breed that he rode.
Yeah.
But it was a popular breed at that time.
Say, do you know about this island off the coast? I don't know. Do you mind if I just... off the coast of Virginia.
Yeah.
And Maryland, where they have the horses.
The wild. Yeah.
Yeah, they're not full-size horses.
Well, they're really wild. Very definitely wild. Yeah.
But they are wild, and... I haven't read anything yet this year, but I know every year I read where
What's
they...
the name of those ponies? They're named after that island.
Yeah, I know. I thought you'd know.
Starts with a C.
Chichester?
Chincoteague.
It's a strange...
Strange Indian name. But there are wild horses off the coast of Virginia.
And they drop... helicopters go over in bad weather when possibly they cannot get anything to eat, and they save the lives of all of them. And a few of them have been brought back, and they have been able to tame a few of them.
Yes.
Do you ever ride a polo pony, by the way?
Listen, you know, it's funny. We were talking about polo. I did a show on polo the other night. And, we got on the subject of sports, and I think sports are really getting bigger and bigger in American life. And I said that my own personal favorite spectator sport, of course everybody would think automatically would be hockey or pro football or baseball. Actually, I don't think there's anything more exciting than a game of polo. You ever seen polo played by experts? It's fantastic.
Do you want to know who is one of the greatest polo players around in this city? And I used to see him on Friday nights right across from where I where I used to live.
Where do you play at, Long Island?
No. Mayor Lindsay. Ex-Mayor Lindsay.
Lindsay
was a marvelous polo player. And you know, it's now a school, and this is up at 94th and Park. It used to be an armory, and they used to have polo matches in there on Friday nights. Now it is a school.
Well, isn't that some fantastic sport to watch?
Oh, absolutely.
And you talk about a sport that it takes guts to play, John.
Yeah.
You see a guy come barreling down that field on a polo pony, going full out with five others coming in at him. It's something.
Yeah. Great courage
and fantastic skill. You have to. They ride. Of course, you know those polo ponies are mostly aren't they little South American horses?
They're smaller than the average horse. And they turn on a dime, and when you say you ride with your knees, all you need to do is have a slight twitch in your leg, and you are spinning around.
And the really good polo ponies will follow the ball. They're really more competitive often than their riders.
Gene, you might appreciate this, and I'll get off horses because I'm sorry, I don't know how we got onto it, but when I was a pre-teenager, I think an awful lot of girls have always loved horses. I don't know why girls, but there's been all the girls I knew when I was growing up. We all went riding. And we went, you know, there were certain things you do. You'd go to dancing school and you'd take riding lessons and so forth. Well, I didn't have riding lessons, but I went riding. The kids, I'd get on my bike and I'd go over. But I could only go once a week. And this goes back to the 30s. And even then, it was a very expensive thing. It cost $5, and that was a lot of money. But to be able to get free rides, they had polo ponies over in the armory in a place called Kingston. So I got my free rides in because I would exercise polo ponies. And that's how I got my freebie riding.
But what great horses to exercise, you know? You know, those polo ponies, if I may, one of the greatest kicks I had in my performing career, John, is a few years back. You remember when John Chancellor was doing the Today Show?
Yes, I do.
Well, I was, at one time, I was on the Today Show as a regular. I had, in a sense, the Joe Garagiola role. And we traveled around the country. Al Morgan was the producer of the show then. And Louise King was the girl. She was the Margaret Walters in that period. And we went down to the Fort Worth cattle auction. Did the whole show there for a whole week. And I was the only one of the three who really could ride Western. Louise rode English, and John rode merry-go-round horses. Badly. So I was the one who did all the riding. So I had some fantastic moments. We went on this cattle ranch. Actually, it was a quarter horse ranch between Dallas and Fort Worth, a famous ranch called the Phillips Ranch. And they had the greatest quarter horse. In fact, they had world champion quarter. It had Jim Eccles there, who was a great, at that time, national champion quarter horse. And they had the three-time winner of the national cutting quarter horse. Have you ever seen a cutting quarter horse? Unbelievable. And he said, you want to go out on him? And I said, sure. So here was this $250,000 quarter horse. You know, I get on this baby, and we start walking out. And this horse, it was like, it's hard to express it. He was like an extension of your own mind. And so this champion rider said, I'm going to give a demonstration. We did it on television. This horse had not done any cutting for a year at that point. He was at stud. See, so they took him out into this corral, and they let these calves go, and they cut a calf for us. And in the first moment he cut this calf, unbelievable, he broke the world's record, this horse.
Mm.
It would be like if you haven't skied in 2 years, and then you go out and you break the world record. And, fantastic horses. And so.
And you rode one?
Oh, yeah. In fact, that afternoon, then, we shot another sequence. We went out to the, down in Texas, they really do it. There's some awfully expensive horse flesh. And so we went to this big arena. I don't recall what the show was. It was some big fair they had down there. And they had the national champion
Arabian Stallion, which was owned by a woman. And so they gave me this horse to ride, and it was the national, at that time, the national champ was 1965, and it was black, rare, very rare, a black, pure black Arabian Stallion. And we went around, I'm riding around on this baby, we went around the ring, and I'm sitting at this horse, and I thought, my God, you know, this horse is probably worth more in actual dollars, John, as you say, the classical buck, than all the executives on New York radio and television combined. And this race, you know, it's such unbelievable sense of presence. And this horse that knew he was the chief. And we went in front of the stands with a great roar of the crowd cheering, and I'm wearing this big 10-gallon hat. You know, and I remember an interview I had that afternoon. I was interviewing somebody from this horse. So I'm sitting on this horse, and the camera dollies in. Who I'm interviewing is fascinating. Two 90-year-old cowboys, both sitting on quarter horses, who had been around back in the days of the Texas Rangers when they really did. They were 90 years old. And these two long, skinny guys, one had been national cowboy champion of 1929 or something, and they're both sitting there. And these two guys with these leathery faces, you know, they made Gary Cooper look like a Girl Scout brownie. Sitting there chewing tobacco, and I said to this one guy, and I said, well, I said, you know, when you're with people like that, you tend to fall into the vernacular. You start to talk like one. He says, well, how do you think things are going these days? Everything normal around here? And he looks at me and says, yep. He's looking bad horse. He said, finally he said something. He said, is that quite a horse you're riding? I said, yep. He says, yours? At that point, I had to make a choice. I just looked at him and spit. You know? It's your good eye for a horse. He says, yep. And that went all coast to coast. We got millions of letters the next day. Just when the shepherd owned the national Arabian champ. But this is a... It's funny, and I...
Do you know the difference between a high school horse and a Liberty horse?
A high school horse?
Or and a Liberty horse.
And a Liberty horse.
They're used in circuses, and a couple of times I've mentioned this, and people will call and ask me what is the difference or what are they, and I really don't know. But when you go to the big show, you find... Possibly many types of horses, but the Liberty horses are trained in a certain way, and the high school horses, now whether they're different breeds or not, I do not know, but they are the performing horses, those, you know, that stand on their hind legs, but I don't know which is, you know, which ones are Liberty or which ones are high school horses.
You mean that's a circus term they use?
No, I don't think it's a circus term. I'm sure they wouldn't just use it in the circus. It must be a horseman's term.
Have you, Candy?
I hadn't, and we had gone over this once before. One of the two is the horse that does dressage, and the other is the horse that just follows. And
that would probably be the high school horse.
Which?
The dressage.
The dressage, I think. And then the Liberty is the one that just is, he just goes around in the parades and he just runs around and he follows.
Well, no, I'm not ragging of the parades. I'm talking about working
in the ring.
Center ring.
Yeah.
And as again, I don't know which is Liberty and which is high school, but the ones where they don't really have a saddle on it, they have something, well, it's bareback, no. And he'll jump, the performer will jump from one to another and then go through the hoops, you know what I mean, with the fire burning and so forth and so on. And they're marvelous horses.
Well, I think a lot of those horses have Belgian blood, wouldn't you say,
yes.
Andy?
Yes.
The
European horses.
The European horses, a lot of them are Hanoverians.
You know what's happening right now. Gray is out of his bird. He's possibly saying, now how in the devil can I get John with my Dixie Cup phone line to tell him the difference of the two? Because I think he told me once, and I didn't, and I really didn't understand the difference.
You know, most circus horses, I think, are European. You're right, Candy, and I think a lot of them are German Hanoverians. Those big Hanover.
You know, if Barry was listening, or if he is listening,
that might be
317. No, that's not Barry there. It would be 317, and Barry would understand what that means, I'm sure. 317.
Well, you know Lee Brown, don't you? Who?
Do I know Lee Brown?
Lee used to be a professional jump rider, Joe.
I didn't know
before
that.
Before she came to me. Yeah, she. She jumped horses in a lot of the shows, big shows around this area for people. And as Candy knows, that's a tough profession.
It sure is.
And she was hurt in an accident.
What?
Horse fell on her. Yes, that's right. And she was in the hospital for about a year. That's why she had to give it up. But she used to exercise horses out at Belmont when she was working with me. You might not have known that, but she...
No, I didn't.
6 o'clock in the morning and 5 and go out there and exercise these thoroughbreds. And, boy.
Did you ever get up to Saratoga?
Yeah, isn't that a beautiful place?
That is the most beautiful place. And a very, just a quickie. I had the great thrill. I was doing a monitor thing up there, and I interviewed, how can I forget his name? He was the greatest race caller of all time. He's retired. Yes, Capistella.
They are off.
And they're off. And I was up in the booth up there, and it was fascinating the way he used to do the horses. He had nothing more than the program folded, just as anybody would buy the 50-cent program was folded. And he had binoculars. And I had my, I think it was a Mohawk. I had a little... was it a Sony? Possibly a Sony portable.
Well, you started with Mohawk tape.
Yeah, but it was after Mohawk. I had been graduated to something else. But anyway, let's say it was a Sony. And in some way, he was watching, following. This was the big race, and he was following the horses around the Travers. And accidentally, I knocked the program down.
Oh.
And he looks down. He put his glasses down, and this is on the air, too, to tell what horse, because he knew number 6, and he'd look at the program to tell what it was. It had fallen down, and fortunately, he remembered whatever horse it was. But what also happened, I was there 2 days, and they gave me the great thrill of pushing the button over at the far corner when they were doing, yeah, I pushed the starter button.
What a,
it was.
What a feeling that was.
And to see that much horse flesh passing, tons and tons of horse flesh, and I was, you know, there's a stand, and you go up this thing, it's almost like a guillotine, and you stand there, and there's a little stick, and there's just a little button on it. And there's a man who does nothing but start the horse races, and he came up with me. And if nothing could happen, of course, and Fred couldn't say, and they're off. And the jocks are all sitting looking at you, and you know.
Those horses are moving.
Yeah, and it's the most thrilling thing.
It
was.
Moment. It really is.
Yeah, it really was. And I had my tape recorder going, and it was all.
Well, you know, Candy, you brought up a lot of memories, because at that time, we did, speaking of being right in the starting arena there, among other things that we did on that Today show was that they had an exhibition quarter horse race. Now, I don't know. Have you ever seen a quarter horse race?
No, I've only seen it on film.
You can't believe it. A quarter horse, John, is the fastest creature in a quarter mile this side of a cannonball. It's incredible.
Mm-hmm.
And they scramble. They don't run like, you know, the thoroughbreds have this long stride. A quarter horse leaps out of the gate. He scurries down there, and they go down in like a pack, like rabbits. Well, I was right down in the starting grid there, and they had 6 quarter horses, and they were all top money-rated quarter horses. I mean, real record-cut quarter horses in there. wild. The eyes are rolling, and they're looking out at you. And I was standing behind. I wasn't starting. I was watching, and I was describing it. And Chancellor was down at the other end, down at the quarter mile pole where they ended.
Yes.
See? And I saw John down there with his microphone, and the bell went, you know, bang, whoom, there's a roar, and there was a great, fantastic cloud of mud he's kicked up. Mud and all kinds of stuff flew back, you know, that you find on racetracks. And it just came flying back. I mean, these horses thundered up. And the thunder was so much, John, that we literally shook us off the air. We had to reshoot the whole thing because they jarred all the equipment. And to get right down on the racetrack and be there when these babies are running, you're right, it's tons.
Yes, yes.
And the horse loves to run. You know how many people don't know this about horses?
Yeah. You know, they think, well, the poor horses out there, and they have to do it. They endure it. This is, they're bred for this.
John, we've been boring you with...
Yeah,
No, you haven't. I thought that Barry would call me 317 and would want to tell us the difference between the Liberty horse and the high school horse, because he is really an expert. Real expert.
Well, you've uncovered a carefully concealed side of Shepherd tonight.
Yes, I never knew this.
Never discussed this, but...
You still riding a cycle?
Motorcycle? No, I haven't had a cycle here for a couple of years. The last one I had was a Honda 305. It was a racing bike.
Yeah.
And it was a good bike, but the odds began to go up. You know, about two or three years ago, the odds of danger went up. And I just finally said, well, I've had the bikes. I rode them for 8-9 years. That was enough.
This is Dialogue Radio 57 WMCA right here in New York City, and this is the Long John Neville Candy Jones Show. And we're talking with Gene Shepherd. Now, I've known Gene for just about 20 years. And we were both sort of hanging around WOR at the time. And Gene was doing a show from 11:15 to 11:30, and then I came on from 11:30 to 12, which is a show, well, it wasn't heard by many people, and at that time, Gene was talking about jawbreakers and...
tongue-in-cheek and putting them down, actually.
That's true, but...
you know, the whole point, the reason I did this stuff, I used to say things like, it was funny how people take you seriously. I'm, a kind of a deadpan comic, and on the air I used to say, things like, it's just really sad to realize that so many of us, our tastes were formed forever by root beer barrels, and,
Well, I enjoyed them. What's wrong with those? Don't put them down.
I always shepherd,
this is my show. Don't put down root beer barrels. They're absolutely fantastic.
Well, I always thought that they were promoted by the American Dental Association. That contributed more to
Carrie's
plot than I think.
If I have the album, but I'd like to have you do one head thumping thing for us tonight.
Gee, I haven't done that in a couple of years.
You think your head is out of tune?
Oh no! I always keep my head. This is a lifelong habit.
Well,
I like Sherlock Holmes when I'm deeply involved in evolving some really deep...
What kind of music?
My head.
What did we have, that great tenor man from the world's greatest jazz band?
Who was that? Was that...
I can't think of his name at the moment. You've got to have something that's really...
Yank Lawson's band.
Yes. Great tenor man.
Yeah. He was.
And if he's listening, he's out of his bird right now that I can't think of his name.
It's the worst thing to have happen, to be driving along and some guy can't remember your name. It's Long John something. It's on the tip of my tongue. Was it Long John Bibble? No. Ishka Bibble? No.
That's really a killer.
John, I must say, I've listened to your show lately. I was on one of those rare occasions when I could get gas in my car. I was driving over in Jersey one night after leaving a friend of mine,
And I turned on the radio, and there you were. Oh, must have been 2:33 in the morning. And I'm going to say, John, coming out of that receiver I had there, that your acerbic wit has never left you. If anything, it's meaner than ever.
Thank you very much. That's a high compliment.
In fact, you were making coleslaw of some guest that night.
Yes.
And I was sitting in the car laughing because he didn't know you were doing it. And you were just chopping him up, and you were about to put the mayonnaise on him.
And it was great to hear a pro at work, you know. No, we still do that if we feel that the guest is entitled to that treatment.
Well, he did. He had it coming. He was a pompous one. He made Al Lotman seem modest.
Do you remember who it was?
No, I don't. I just remember you, John, saying, well, on the other side of the picture, he said, I'm going to take... And I could hear the guy sitting there wheezing away. You were landing on him, but... do you ever see any of your old compatriots, the Brooklyn Barber?
No, I haven't seen the Tom Sorrelatus from Brooklyn for a number of years.
I miss Howard Menges and all those.
Howard Menger.
Yeah,
he's in Florida someplace developing a new craft, which the plans were given to him by a Venusian who spent about 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
At his home in
Florida. Well, they do that. They spend a lot of time down at his retirement homes.
So, you know, this keeps going on. A lot of people ask for some of the old shows to be replayed, and I have a big stock of them here. But unfortunately, we haven't had editing time because there's station IDs and things like that. And we have...
What was his name? The science fiction...
Lester Del Rey, Lester. The Magnificent.
Yeah, Lester. Is he still around?
Oh, yes. Lester is with us, and Fred Pohl is with us, and Sandy Teller. And all of those major names in broadcasting are still around, I'm delighted to say.
A ponderous crew.
Candy, did you ever hear Mr. Shepherd do head thumping?
Do what?
Well, I'm not going to tell you anymore. I'm not going to tell you anymore. And if you'll be... kind enough to talk with Shep for a couple of minutes, I am going to go out and look through my albums because I want you to hear. This is absolutely fantastic. If I can find the album that I want. So, will you bear with me a moment?
Did you say something about head thumping?
Head thumping.
Okay. You're going to look for head thumping?
Actually, he... was able to get some of his instructions through the head of the percussion department of Manny's Music Shop, Danny Bergauer.
Danny's worked with me by the hour.
That's right. And he also is a magnificent man on the jawharp.
The jawharp.
The jawharp.
Well, it's actually the Jew's harp.
Oh,
that
yeah.
Used to be, but...
Why do they call it jawharp now?
Well, I don't know. We had certain complaints that came in from...
Well, that's like calling an English horn something else.
That's right.
What's the matter with that?
Call it a German.
A French horn now becomes an Algerian flute. I mean, it's kind of strange. You know? In fact, you know, it's getting to me today that if you even mention a nationality on the air without saying anything about it at all, just mention it. You get 5 angry letters.
You have to.
That's right.
5 people pick at you.
That's right.
I mean, all you have to do is say something like, Belgium.
Yeah.
And 7 guys say, what was that you said last night? And
you know, we had a letter that came in with, I was quoting from a review from the New York Times book review section, mm-hmm. quoting a man's, about a man's book, and I... had the review, and I said, I quote, and I read the quote, unquote. Now, a letter came in, it was directed to the head of the station, in which it said that I had said the quote. It was my personal interpretation, and the quote was obviously not that flattering, but it was a whole series of things, and then...
it was about Anne Frank.
The Diary of Anne
Frank. And... when that was produced on Broadway, the gentleman who wrote the book and had collaborated with the father of Anne Frank the people who produced it, Kermit Bloomgarden, and Lillian Hellman, who was involved as the show doctor and all, they indicated that they felt that the manner which he had written it, the author, Meyer Levin, that it was, and these are quotes, too Jewish. And some, I'm not sure if it was a lady or a gentleman that wrote in, and naturally they only listened with half an ear and indicated that it was an anti-Semitic remark. Well, it wasn't, because this is the review in the New York Times about his book, The Obsession. And he has written a book. Actually, Meyer Levin is a very fine writer. He did Compulsion, and we've had him on a number of times. But he is very peeved, and he feels that Anne Frank's father sold out, and therefore it should be litigated. He feels that he should be brought to the halls of justice.
Right.
Not Meyer, but Anne Frank's father.
Now, I know that today it's. I think there's a great sickness that's traveling around the world, and it's a kind of sickness that that really, in a sense, says that my desires and what I need are the most important things in the world. If you don't accept that, I'll kill you, or in words to that effect.
Yeah, and the terrible thing is that people are doing that.
Well,
they
sure
they go right out and they kill the situation.
Well,
this,
first.
Yeah, exactly.
Classic example.
$70 for every person who's on...
Well, I'm just curious where we're headed. I think that, you know, I was thinking about that coming down here tonight. I was walking along 57th Street, and it just hit me. I don't know why I thought this. I don't know whether other people think like this, but, you know, it just hit me. I was walking across 7th Avenue, and suddenly hit me. I could see, I saw paper swirling along 57th Street. It used to be an elegant street, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I see this, there's a restaurant all boarded up, and it's kind of looking real sad and defeated. And then the window is an old Q review of their past glory. You know, really depressing.
Yeah.
And suddenly hit me. I thought to myself, well, you know, I wonder if a lot of us who are alive at this time are aware that we could be at the end of a great era. In other words, civilization is over.
I don't think you're alone.
And we're beginning a new age of barbarism. In other words, the barbarism of the early days, one of the things that set the barbaric peoples apart, I'm talking about back in the very, the really, the age of barbarism, Attila the Hun, and the great ages of the conquerors, was that a country would run roughshod over other countries.
Mm-hmm.
A leader would run roughshod over another country or another people. And I wonder whether or not we're getting into that again.
Well, when you think of the situation with the Getty Boy, for example, the cruelty of cutting off an ear and
That's the kind of thing that would have happened in Attila the Hun's day.
Of course.
Sure.
They used to send back a limb.
And remember, this is in a comparatively civilized country. This is Italy.
Right.
This is not happening in some backwater, savage part of the world.
But, you know, this request in which, and I have not really read the papers for today, which is what, Wednesday already? Yeah, Wednesday. I just saw the headline, and I heard a little bit of it on the news as we were getting ready for the show and ready to welcome the Great Shepherd. But the $70 requested for each person, each poverty person who was a poverty case in the state of California, and they were going to keep her until this would be accomplished, and then they would start to negotiate. I just wondered if there... Oh, and this happened. This is what I started to say. This happened in Argentina. They had the same thing with a... I believe it was a similar group in Buenos Aires.
Oh, sure. This has happened.
In which they ask, this is
and
not...
they paid. There was a... You're talking about an executive...
Ford Motor Company.
Well, this is a kind of a cosmic, barbaric lawlessness that's going through the world. And, of course, it's all done with a great air of righteousness. It's not done with... It's always done with... we're trying to clear up the evil in the world. That's why we've captured you and we're killing you.
Yeah. They say that she is being kept under the conditions of the Geneva Peace Conference, or the Geneva Peace... Yeah. What was it, conference?
Well, when in doubt, always trot out a great cliche about peace. This is an old slogan among radical groups. And it persists. I'm just curious, because we see this now today with the oil nations are again, they're doing it, this cosmic blackmail.
Mm-hmm.
They happen to have a considerable amount of the world's oil under their soil, so they're, in effect, blackmailing the rest of the world to believe what they believe or back their causes, or else they pick up their marbles and go home.
Well, they're going home.
I just wonder whether the reaction to this could be a return to the old days of imperialism. In other words, it's even been implied where certain countries have implied and veiled. Not us. We haven't said this yet.
You're talking about France?
Well, not only France, but I think it was also said by a couple of British statesmen,
mm-hmm.
where they implied that ultimately, to preserve the world, ultimately, military intervention, maybe. This is the kind of thing that they had back in the 18th and 19th centuries, where a country would go into another country merely to keep the peace of the world.
Yeah.
And I just wonder where it's all heading. It'd be fascinating.
I don't know whether it's fascinating. It's fascinating.
It's historically fascinating, Kenny.
Yeah.
You know,
how could we go backwards in civilization?
Well, because I think we always do. You know, Americans aren't much hip on history. We think history is reading about the Civil War. And that's only 100 years ago or so. That's not history to most other places in the world. That's recent events. And it always comes as a surprise to a lot of Americans to realize that there have been periods in the world, thousands of years ago, where civilizations were at a very high peak and then declined.
Mm-hmm.
And they seem to go through those cycles. Of course, I suppose at any given time, if you're living in one of those societies, it's impossible for you to conceive of it declining.
Exactly.
I can't imagine a guy walking around the streets of Athens in the age of Pericles looking around and saying to himself, well, one day this shall all be ruined and I'll be selling postcards.
Right.
And this will be a grubby little tourist haven and the Greek civilization will have disappeared practically. He couldn't see that. And we can't either. We can't see this.
Yeah.
It's difficult for us to see that maybe 4,000 years from now, 4,000, I said, people will slowly begin to be coming out of another great dark age. And they will look back on our time as we look back on the age of the Greeks.
Mm-hmm.
There's a period when people wrote books and people read and people, as you notice, there's an advancing illiteracy in the world.
That's true.
Now my book here, I've been shocked ever since I've gotten really seriously into writing in the last 10 years, Candy, to realize how few people actually read.
Well, and yet book sales, paperback sales, are up tremendously.
See, I'm going to tell you, they're what the industry calls non-books. They're sex books. They're how-to books.
Well, the how-to book is not a book.
That's called a non-book.
That's a non-book, right.
Words,
non-books sell. Cookbooks, non-books.
Yeah.
Right. What is a sex book?
Well, Dr. Rubin.
Yeah, that's a non-book.
That's
too.
A non-book.
Right.
And of course, the fiction itself, and I'm a fiction writer, you rarely hear fiction people, for example, even being interviewed on television. You'll not see Philip Roth on TV, but you will see some guy who's written a cockamamie little book on how to cheat on your taxes.
We had him on.
Yeah, that guy. So this is all a sign of an advancing, curious kind of illiteracy. Mm-hmm. Now, I taught here about 3 years ago. Remember, John, when I was teaching at NYU?
Yes, I do.
And I was astounded to find people in my classes. I had 95 people, and they were all going for advanced degrees, many of them for their doctorates. How many of them had not read classical pieces of literature, which I would mention in class? Like I asked the class if any of them had read Nathaniel West. Two hands went up. These are people that are going to be teachers. I got a letter the other day from a kid, by the way, who was trying to do a book review on Wanda Hickey, this book John has right here.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you know, my teacher, who teaches English over here in Clifton High School, Clifton, New Jersey, he said, I wanted to review your book. And so apparently they have to get prior permission of the teacher to come to the room. She said, well, I never heard of him. And he says, well, he's written a lot of books, and he's in magazines, and he's so forth. She said, well, I haven't heard of him. He says, well, then can I do a book review on H.H. Monroe, the famous short story writer of the 1920s, World War One period? And she says, well, look, she says, I don't know who this man is. He finally tried to get her to approve Thurber, and this woman had never read James Thurber, had heard his name.
She'd never even heard
of him. That's right. It's not impossible. It's a common problem today. And
how do they get to be teachers?
Well, because a number of things. A lot of people get a lot of their education today through films. They don't read much. They read a lot of workbooks. They read a lot of survey courses. But to actually read a book is a real chore to many people today. And this is a sign of, I think, a real interesting sign. And so you'll notice that the increasing violence on television, you can hardly turn on any television show today without hearing the sound of gunfire and the thunk of karate and the screams of sirens, no matter what the show is about. So you're saying
that sound is a very big thing.
Oh, yes.
Too.
The love of violence, the love of mass movements, you find in our time the great mass movements, the great Dylan crowds, the great Woodstocks. This is all a sign of a curious herd barbarism, merging the South into a kind of orgiastic whole. Mm-hmm. Which is very, very barbaric and
reminiscent of what had happened in times long gone.
That's right, when the great Mongol hordes had come shooting down out of the mountains. And I seriously feel that history will be looking back. There will be a Gibbon eventually. There will be a Gibbon, and he will maybe 1,500, 1,000 years from now will begin to write about this great age, which began, I would say, probably around 1300, the year 1300. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah,
back that far?
I think the age that we're living in began about 1300. This is when the first signs of literacy began to grow, and the monks began to gather knowledge and so on. And then the Renaissance, of course. And then the great age of reason, and now we're living in the age of Marcus Welby. And God knows where we go from there.
My name's Long John Neville.
I'm Candy John.
And our guest tonight is Gene Shepherd.
I wish you could have said Mickey Mouse.
Why?
Our guest is the original Mickey Mouse. He's here tonight. He's brought Minnie with him.
Double M?
No, I just wish that we could have, sometimes occasionally have really exciting guests. The guest syndrome is so much with us today in television and radio. Wouldn't you love to have Donald Duck as a guest?
I think that's Donald Bain you're talking about.
No, I mean the real Donald Duck. I mean, some great character out of American mythology. For example, it would become...
Sneezy.
Sneezy, yeah. or have, say, for example, Pluto.
Mm-hmm.
Remember Pluto?
Oh, I love Pluto.
Yeah, and...
I like Sandy.
Sandy? Well, yeah, he had very limited vocabulary. He didn't have much of a role. He was always just standing there going, "Arf."
Are you still doing the Ovaltine bit?
Oh, no. I don't do bits really like that, John. You know, it's funny. That damn thing has pursued me, John, like I one time talked to a famous violinist, Isaac Stern. And every time he goes anywhere, somebody insists that he plays the same thing that he once played years ago in a concert, and they love it. And that piece, particular bit, which is really a short story, it was a short story about discovering, you know, most of our literature is about discovering sex, as you know, the Graduate, the Philip Roth story, Portnoy Complaint. But my feeling is that Americans have long since outgrown the Freudian problem. And that there are many things we discover in our lives which are equally traumatic, if not more so, than sex. And one of them is to discover that things are not what they're advertised to be. And when you're 16 and you're walking past a used car lot every day, and you see this magnificent Ford Fairlane sitting there gleaming, and you go past it week after week after week, and you begin to lust for it with a fantastic, uncontrollable lust. And you get a job in the bowling alley, and you get a job working in the A&P in the checkout line. You save every cent. And 2 years later, you finally get on a friendly Fred, the hungry Armenian, the man standing there with those chrome teeth smiling. You walk in and you put your dough down, you drive it out, and 20 minutes later you discover you have bought a silly putty transmission. And it has a balsa wood differential. You go over your first set of railroad tracks and the frame is a U-shaped frame. You're looking in the back window of the car as you're driving. This is a trauma you do not forget. All of your life, you will wake up with cold sweats at 3 in the morning, remembering how that car went over those railroad tracks and how those shock absorbers bottomed out. And that great cloud of smoke behind you. With these noxious fumes, you get maybe 2 or 3 gallons of oil to the mile. And these are traumas. I mean, and Freud never knew about them. He never knew this kind of a trauma. And a guy from that day on looks at many things with a jaundiced eye. He does. And he can't ever go back again. Thomas Wolfe was right. And that little Orphan Annie thing is about a kid. And we've all lived it. See, the Orphan Annie thing, I think you can tell the age of a person by whether or not he exclaims over the frame of the painting, Candy,
mm-hmm.
or the subject.
Mm-hmm.
And most people who hear that story, if they're of a certain age, they begin to immediately reminisce about Orphan Annie, missing the point of the story.
Mm-hmm.
The point of the story was a kid who every day listened to the radio. Now, it could be watching television. It could be reading Playboy.
And it was that moment of, who's that little chatterbox?
Well, that wasn't the moment. The moment was when he felt that he was not in. If you recall, every day he would sit there and they would come on at the end of the show. And they would say, and now it's time for a secret message to the members of the Little Orphan Annie secret society. Now, at this point, now, you see, immediately you're getting nostalgic. This is not what it's about.
No, but I wanted to be one of the numbers.
Well, who doesn't? As a matter of fact, every Playboy reader wants to become a Playboy type, and they buy a little bunny to put on the back of their board, you know, and they put it on their false Hollywood pipes and stuff, and somehow the idea that the Hefner and all the boys of Playboy lived in this strange wonder, it's like living in Oz. When you read the Oz stories, you wanted to be in Oz, didn't you?
Sure.
All right. And so we all had this desire. And so that's what that story's about. It's the desire to be in something.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the show, this announcer would come on and he'd say, "All right, boys and girls,
set your decoder pin at B7. Now, before we go any further, I'd like to say that any of you who would like to become a member of Little Apennine Secret Society, send in the silver initial from a can of Ovaltine, the rich, chocolatey drink.
Pierre André.
And now, here is the message. 7-22-19-8. Well, when this thing goes off, and you're living in a non-Ovaltine drinking neighborhood, and you have the sense that out there in the darkness, millions of kids are decoding, getting the real message. And all you can do is go in the kitchen, make a salami sandwich, look out in the darkness, where you see all these cross clotheslines of the depraved Midwest. You begin to fester. You want to. The first learning within a kid to climb out of his level of society, to move upward. And this kid, one day, comes home from school and listening to this show for weeks. And he's walking down an alley. They had alleys in Chicago and still do, by the way, John. I don't know what an alley is in New York.
No, they don't.
But an alley is a curious street behind the house, for any of you who don't know what an alley is. And it's usually covered with garbage. And the kid's walking along, and he's kicking tin cans, carnation milk cans. You know, you go through a period when you're about 10, when you're totally alone. Yeah, you begin to suspect that girls really are different. And it's exciting. He's walking along and he sees an unbelievable sight there in the middle of a bunch of thrown out stuff, old tires, bed springs and garbage and potato peel and coffee grounds, is an Ovaltine can. The first one he's actually seen. He looks at the can, picks it up, and whoever had bought the can had pushed the silver inner seal, just pushed it down, used the Ovaltine, threw the can out with the seal. Talk about rich. Threw the seal away. Picks it up, takes the seal out, goes home, writes a letter to Little Orphan Annie. He closes the silver inner seal, says, Little Orphan Annie, I always drink Ovaltine. I want to be a member of the secret society. Here is my silver inner seal. And sends it to Checkerboard Square, which incidentally is another great American religious location. And all of us secretly would like to spend a week at Checkerboard Square or Battle Creek. In the actual, on the hallowed ground of Mr. Post invented greatness. Which has changed the lower colon of many an American. And the kid sits there and sends off the letter. And then begins one of the great travails of his life. Waiting. Almost everything important in your life involves a period of almost unbearable waiting. And he waits and waits, and every day the mailman walks by. Once in a while he comes up, delivers stuff, puts it in the mailbox. It's always marked occupant. The old man takes a look at one of those occupants. I always remember looking at the occupant one, and he tears it open. It says, you need $300. On your signature moment, you need no cosigners. He hurls it down. He says, how the hell did they know? They don't even know my name, and they know I'm in trouble. Occupant. They're all in trouble, friends, out there in the howling darkness of the night. And he, day after day, waits. One day, the mailman comes up the walk and delivers a fat, lumpy letter with his name on it. Lumpy. You could feel bumps in it.
And it's exciting just to feel it. Even to this day, John, I get excited when I get a letter that has lumps in it. I tell you, something rattles when you know. And he picks it up and it rattles. And he goes in the house and he carefully opens it. And he dumps it out on the dining room table with the lace tablecloth. You know, the one with the orange cut glass bowl with the wax fruit? The orange bowl, which was Hollywood pearline ware, which came from the Orpheum Theater. Shakes it out. And there is his membership card in gold. So to be a member for life and to be given all the rights and honors accruing thereto. Member of the Orphan Anti-Secret Society. Gene P. Shepherd, signed in ink by Pierre Andre himself. Membership card, the first one. And the first membership card you get in your life is even more traumatic than your first sexual experience, really, in America today. Freud would have known about this. Many guys today collect yards of these things, keep them in glass envelopes. Diners, clubs, carte blanche, American Express. I have a diner's club card that I treasure. I go to the meetings. Over at the old diner's club, we sit around and talk about Howard Johnson. All the greats in American diner club history. And he gets this membership card, and what made it so sweet was because it was the most beautiful kind of card to own. It was in. But what made it even better? And in the true American tradition, he was a phony. He was a non-Ovaltine drinking member. Which, I mean, the illicit is always much more fantastic than the licit. And then he shakes the envelope again, and out comes his secret decoder pin with simulated gold knob. And he's ready. And that night, he listens to the adventure, you know, the whole business Joe Cointasso. They're chasing the smugglers and everything. You know, let's get back down to the nitty-gritty. And finally, on comes Pierre Andre, and he says, "Boys and girls, here's tonight's message for the members of the Little Orphan Annie Secret Society. All set now. Set your pins at B12. Ready? Take this message down. 9. 13. 4. 36. 12. He could get more out of numbers than Orson Welles could get out of King Lear. 3. 22. 8. And the kid's writing it down. And he finally finishes off and says, "All right, boys and girls, there's your secret message. Don't forget tomorrow, this same time at 5:15, when the Little Orphan Annie Secret Society meets once again, when you hear the song, 'Who's That Little Chatterbox?'" And he, the hell with this. And he runs. He's got the message. His first message. Where do you decode? This is secret. So he goes to the only room in the house where a boy of 9 can decode in privacy. Locks the door. And begins to decode. 4. Moves the knob. After it's been set at B12. 4. Let's see. B. Writes down the letter B. That's the first letter, B. 17. E. B-E, that's a word. B. 34. S. 9. U. Be sure. R. R. E. Be sure. 19. T. 18. O. 3. D. 12. R. I-N-K-O-V-A-L. A crumbing commercial.
mortal orphan in yourself. And at that minute, the scales began to slowly fall from the eyes, and the world was never again quite the same.
Beautiful.
Yeah, beautiful,
Gene.
I haven't done that in 5 years.
That's beautiful.
Folks, and I are going to leave you here alone with your head.
Now, are you in tune?
Are you going to
well, oh, yes, I'm always. No, I'm always in tune. A really dedicated head player for the, your information, Candy. It's called Kopfspielen. It's originally an Austrian form of musical expression. And the head thumpers throughout history have been rather covert about their work, often apologetic. And from I'm serious. And from the age of five, I personally have kept my head in good shape. I wear a beret every night when I sleep, soaked in neat's foot oil. And otherwise, an untreated head tends to become dry, millions of tiny cracks, and there's a mushy tone. And I have a C melody alto head, which is one of the rarest, yes. And fortunate. I'm telling you the truth. When you hear it, you'll know what we mean. So I don't like to perform on the head to people who take it lightly. It's a serious. It is a serious musical expression. And in fact, I did this one night, and I've got a secret. I performed. Let's see who was on it that night. Betsy Palmer, Henry Morgan. And I did it with the Irving Fields Quartet. You might have seen the show. Yeah. It was a wild show.
It was repeated many times.
They used to use that tape over and over again. Gary Moore was on the show in those days. And I have, I'm one of the few people who've actually worked as a professional head thumper. I'm listed in Local 802. And my instrument is the head.
I'm not kidding.
I'm
no,
serious.
This is very.
And you know how they got to me? I've got a secret. 802 called me. It's the only one I'm listed in all of New York City. And I said, well. Okay. And so I appeared on I've Got a Secret, and I've done it in two reviews. I did this in a review down in the Orpheum Theater. On 2nd Avenue, a review. Do you remember? You know the theater down there, don't you?
Yeah.
Well, this was a show that was produced, believe it or not, by Jerry Kretschmer, the Environmental Protection Agency guy. And Jerry was a producer.
Sure has changed.
Oh, no, he's still in show business. Jerry hadn't changed at all. He's just gotten louder. But Jerry produced this show, and I performed every night. Rousingly successful show, John remembers.
Yeah,
show,
no, man.
And I performed with a band the whole bit.
I can't wait.
Well, now, wait a minute. I think, because you can't hear this way, I think, is the monitor open in the... I think what we should do, because you want to watch him. And I think we should do, Candy... I'll give you a cue, which my engineer will see. Actually, we're very fortunate to have an album by Marion and Jimmy McPartland, and the number is Avalon. No, the other side for you to adjust. You want to get levels or anything?
Yeah.
Could you just give us maybe about 8 bars? You want to hear 8 bars?
I just want to get a little more level there.
Just play a little bit first. And because we want to watch you.
Okay, now he'd better get a level on my head here. All set?
Do you want to get a level on his head? You hear?
Okay. Now, right. give me just a little touch of that echo chamber, okay?
You can direct the engineer.
I certainly will.
He will be out there watching you.
All right, I've had experience here, John. All right.
Thank you very much.
All right, I'll just... Not yet. Cut the echo for a second here until John gets back into his... Now, the reason we use an echo chamber here is not because our head is not properly tuned for non-echo work, but it gives a nice effect for those who like the more rococo in music. All Sam? And when you start the record, immediately go into that little echo, and I'll be ready to go. Okay? Go.
Thank you. Haven't done that in a long time. How'd that sound in there? Oh, no, no. No headache. Not to a properly trained head. I feel like a tap dancer on the Ed Sullivan Show.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Haven't done that since I was on the air with you the last time.
That's right. We had Bud Friedman with us that.
Yeah.
She's looking at your head.
And well, she might.
That is just great. Now, if anybody thinks that's a put on, you're 100% wrong. Now, we had a sit in what's called a sponsor's booth so we could listen and actually see Gene work. Now, that is possibly the only man, to my knowledge, in America who's doing head thumping.
Well, serious head thumping. A lot of guys, you know, fool around with it. But we are a very tight community, head thumpers. About seven of us. We correspond.
You really do?
We have a newsletter.
And it goes like this.
You know what that takes. I'll tell you what it takes. First of all, it's very deceptive. When you see it done, it probably looks quite, you know, really wild, pretty grotesque. But a lot of people do not, when they try it, they quickly realize in about 30 or 40 seconds that it takes insane concentration. That's the real thing, concentration. And also, you have to have an ear, of course, as well as a very talented head. Many are born with heads, but few are chosen. Is the way it works. But how'd it sound in there, Candy?
Beautiful. Just great. Can you do, would you like to hear a little of it?
Well, I've heard it before, but if you care to, sure. What does it sound like to you, Candy? I'm just curious.
It sounded like a musical instrument I'd never heard before. It was an instrument.
Well, now, I'm going to tell you something that may surprise you, and it is a fact. Do you know that composers in the late 17th century and early 18th century did write for Kopfspielen? Kopfspielen, of course, is the German word meaning head. Head singing.
Head singing.
Head music.
Head talking.
Head music, really. And there was a very famous Kopfspieler who traveled, in fact, had music written for him. I believe that even Beethoven wrote a piece for him. He traveled all throughout Europe and was a highly regarded concert performer. that instrument, and it is an instrument, that instrument... still persists in certain places in the world. How I got involved in it is a long, dull story. But I started this when I was a kid. Actually, did.
Mm-hmm.
He's got this queued up, and
do you want to hear? Now you see that before he plays this, I have to explain something to you. This is not really the kind of music I would have used. And John went back and just picked this out of the library, just pulled something out. I'd never heard this before. And like anything else, if I worked on it, then...
You couldn't have made it more beautiful.
Yes, indeed. You'd be surprised what work does. In fact, when we did it in a review, it was actually a concert piece. I had a small group composed of a cornet, believe it or not, a lute, and a lute, a snare drum, and a violin. And they were really a strange group, and they were playing behind the curtain, and this is what I did in the review, and they played this behind the curtain, and I played a 1-minute etude by Chopin on the head. It was fantastic.
Which
we used to bring the house.
Do you recall?
I don't recall now, but it was a Chopin etude. It took about 60, 65 seconds to play. But we did it without any warning. All of a sudden, I broke into this thing. And in the middle of a wild scene with blue lights on me, it was very avant-garde review and just brought the house down. But can you hear this now?
Yes, please.
Okay. Just so you hear. Okay.
Shepherd playing on his head. Candy and I are sitting in here now just reviewing it once more. And it is really great. Maybe we could find one more later. First, we have to... he's right now putting Neat's Foot oil on his head.
Always carry it with me.
Yes. And...
what kind of oil?
Neat's Foot. Have you ever used it on your boots?
No, I don't...
You're kidding me.
No, I use saddle soap.
Well, that's for cleaning.
Well, it's for softening and...
Well, no, Neat's Foot oil is the...
that's the real thing. Neat's Foot
oil.
The
real thing.
It's
on your saddle and all?
No.
So, actually, mostly outfielders use it. It's
on the glove.
On the glove.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Neat's Foot. N-E-A-T-S.
Yes, yes.
Is this? Isn't that just
funny? N-E-E-T-S. Neat's
Foot. Oh, yeah, that's right.
N-E-E-T-S.
What? Yeah.
Neat's right, foot. Yeah, yeah, because the kids used to have it, that's right, for
right.
their baseball yeah. mess.
And the Neat's Foot that I use is the head Neat's Foot, which contains lanolin.
Yes.
They do have it for
it also yes. curbs dandruff.
Yeah.
And, yes, I rub it into my head every night, and I keep the head soft and pliable.
Yeah. Very important because he's playing a C melody. You see, in reed instruments... You have the alto horn, you have the tenor horn, and you have the C melody. And that's what Wilbert plays,
that's
is
right.
C melody.
All right, that's right.
Yeah. Very difficult to keep in tune a C melody reed instrument. They'll either play it straight or as a miniature saxophone. And Wilbert plays this in the world's greatest jazz band.
Sidney Bechet plays.
Well, he studied with Sidney Bechet.
Yeah, great C melody player.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
And I'm not being facetious, I'm not trying to be funny, but could your head go out of tune?
It certainly can if it's not taken care of properly. That's what we're talking about.
Yeah. You see, a C melody,
yeah.
which you don't understand, in other words, if you were or E-flat alto horn, it stays in tune if you know how to blow this reed instrument. But for some reason, a soprano sax, it's called a soprano instrument, or the C melody, and this has a tendency of going out of tune while you're playing. So
right in the middle of a
you
phrase.
Have to compensate for that immediately. I mean, you can't say to the audience, let's start from the top, because my instrument went out
right.
of tune.
Yeah.
And that's the toughest... One, that's why I never realized he was C melody. I automatically thought he was possibly E flat alto. But he isn't. It's the toughest tuning to keep in...
Now, if I didn't keep my head in shape, it would slip down to an E flat alto.
Yes.
And, of course, at that point, I'd have to play an entirely different repertoire of music. And it's not quite as dramatic. The C melody is a very dramatic instrument.
And we are not kidding you, Candy. This is not a put-on
really,
because
no.
you watched him.
I know.
And you saw him play. And right now... I'm sorry we didn't have the Bud Friedman album.
Oh, this was a fine album. Who is this?
Marion and Jimmy McPartland.
McPartland.
Yeah, I gave you the Buddy Hackett, and if you can find something on there, maybe a little later.
On that. I don't ordinarily work to Dixie. This is kind of a... Actually, this isn't Dixie. This is Chicago. Chicago.
The
yeah.
one that you just played was Chicago.
Yeah, Chicago.
Yeah.
So is this... this Hackett, too.
It is Chicago?
Matter of fact, they recorded it on Melrose Avenue, it says. That's
well, that's Chicago.
That sure is Chicago.
You know, I've told Candy a lot of the stories about things that happened when we were at WOR together. One story I've told her, but certainly not in the great detail that you're in a position to tell the story. Herb Salzman, who is a general manager now of WOR, he was a man who always had some ideas to increase sales. He's really sales-oriented, not as much program-oriented as he is sales-oriented. And this happens in this business. The general manager can be really a former program director or a former sales manager. And Certainly we all have admiration for Herb Salzman. But one particular time, and I'm not going to blow the story because I just want to lead into it. And I'd had many of these experiences, but Gene Shepherd was going to be a judge of a beauty contest. And a limousine is picking him up about 7 o'clock. A Smith's limousine to take him out to this theater where he's going to appear in person. He's a celebrity, a big name, no doubt. Hundreds of people will be turned away because Gene will be there to select the beauty of that neighborhood. It was a very, very hot day, June or July of that particular year. Gene is standing in front of 1440 Broadway in all of his splendor. It is still daylight saving time. The sun is just gradually fading away, and the limousine is about 10 minutes late already.
And I stood around and looked up and down the street. See, I'm expecting this limousine. You know, I'm looking for a Cadillac or at least a Lincoln. And it's getting hotter and hotter, later and later, and I realize that at 7 o'clock I'm supposed to be there. That's when the beauty queens were going to make their big appearance, and I was going to judge them along with several other eminent New Yorkers. Incidentally, Candy, have you ever appeared yourself in a beauty contest?
Mm-hmm.
It's a curious experience to be sitting there, to be sitting in judgment. Because beauty is in the eye of the beholder. And I'll tell you what I found out about it that night. It was getting hotter and hotter, and I got a little desperate. See, so I finally figured, well, something's going wrong here. And, you know, there's a certain thing you get involved in.
Wasn't it Kirsch Beverage sponsoring it?
Okay.
No, I guess it was some other...
I don't think it was.
No, that's right.
With somebody else.
Good.
Yes.
But it was... I don't recall who sponsored it, actually, to be honest with you. It was such a hellish experience that night that it's almost like a Freudian erasure. You know, you erase certain things that are happening to you, even as they're happening. Your mind keeps like a tape recorder. You've got it on erase. And it's getting hotter and hotter. And have you ever been involved in a thing which was given to you it was going to be a grand experience. You know, it's going to be very elegant. Everything's going to be very show, theater, theatrical, and elegant. And I was kind of looking forward to this for about 2 or 3 days. But as this... At this moment, I had a faint premonition, faint inkling, that something was not quite right. And man is a creature of great instincts. He doesn't even have to understand them. I know that at this moment, I said, uh-oh, something's going on. And I went back into the station, seeing as well, I better call, because it's already now about 6:45, about 20 minutes to 7, so he's going to wait. He's supposed to pick me up about 6:15. And I've been waiting down in front of this place for all this time. The people walking by and traffic is thinning out. So I run back upstairs and I call Mr. Salzman. And I get him on the phone. He says, you mean they're not there yet? And I says, no, there's nobody there yet. He says, well, you go down and wait. He says, no, don't, we're counting on you. He says, you know, they really need you out there. It's going to be a big, big event. I said, well, gosh, what am I doing? He says, well, you go down and wait. He says, they'll be there. So I go down and I wait on the curb. I'm there about 5 minutes, and I notice parked over by a fire hydrant about a 1953 Dodge that had seen much better times. In fact, this Dodge, I could see the left rear spring was broken. It had several large dings on it. Somebody's written a well-known Anglo-Saxon four-letter word in the dust on the rear trunk. And this guy gets out, and he walks over towards me, and he says, hey, he said, so you're all around here? I says, yes. You know, idea. I never heard of anybody mugging a whole radio station. Yes, they're here and they're alarmed.
Is this guy named Shepard around here?
Yes. My worst fears had been realized. I was being picked up. The guy says, I'm supposed to pick you up. I says, oh, you are?
Yep.
He says, hurry up, we're late. So I said, yes, we are. I said, where have you been? He said, I've been waiting around the corner. I says, well, I was told to meet you here. He says, yeah, but there's no parking here. I says, yes, it is. And so we got in the car. I got in the back seat, and it was, you know, I tried to pretend it was still a limousine, you know, back seat of this 53 Dodge Coronet. And I sat down, the springs were coming out of the seats, and I was sitting there, and I had a tasty collection of old Rheingold cans in the back there, and up around my ankles, you know, a couple of cigar butts, and we took off. And we headed downtown, see? And so, here we are, and I'm thinking myself, and incidentally, I have to point out something very salient to this. This is a very important point. I am wearing a rented tuxedo. Which added a certain panache to the whole fair. And here I am, it's broad daylight, and I'm riding in the back seat of a 53 Dodge, which had been battered and torn from pillar to post, and I'm riding down, and people are looking in. You know, we'd stop at a stoplight, guys would look in there, I'm sitting there with this little I had a maroon tie that was clipped on my shirt, collar, and I'm beginning to sweat through it. And by the way, there was a little scene at the station about who was going to pay for the rented tuxedo. Started the whole thing off on a happy note. So we're driving downtown. I figure, you know, everything's under control. So we arrived down on some obscure bridge down way down on the far end of Manhattan. And we start across the bridge. When all of a sudden, we're riding in the middle of traffic, the guy hollers over the roar. He had bad tappets in his car, by the way. You couldn't hear anything. And it was one of these cars, you know, that has a muffler that hits a certain resonant frequency. Have you ever been in a car where the muffler's going, and you're hollering over the, you know, the muffler, and he hollers. He said, hey, where are we going? He doesn't know where we're going. I says, well, you're going to take me where the beauty contest is. I said, what the hell's that? I says, well, it's gotta be over there somewhere, over there, towards Queens. He says, well, he says, we better find out because we're gonna get in the traffic down there by the end of the street. So I'm getting frantic. So we get off the bridge, and at that point I says, well, I better make a call, find out where this place is. At this point he does not know where. He's been told by whoever he works for, just come and pick this guy up. And he was somebody's brother-in-law, by the way. Everybody in Queens is somebody's brother-in-law. So we stopped at the light. I said, wait a minute. So I went into a Shell station wearing a rented tuxedo. Jump out of this 53 Dodge trying to look like Fred Astaire. And it ain't easy when you're in this old tin canyon. I did run out of places. Jumped over the grease pits, you know, and I ran into the Shell station. I says, where's the phone? And the guy looks up, and he's sitting there, you know, he's drinking a Pepsi or something. He looks up, and he says, what the hell are you doing? He says, where's the wedding, buddy? And he's laughing, ha-ha, yuck. I said, well, I want the phone. I don't want any jokes. Give me the phone. And he says, it's over there. So I go over to the phone, you know, it's one of these greasy phones that you have in gas stations, you know, with names written all over it, said Marie, and all that, great numbers to call. So I figured at that point, I'm just going to give up the whole damn thing and call Marie and go wherever she is. Spend the night in my tuxedo. Never come back. Oh, geez. When you think of the things you have to do, we're going to have to answer for a lot when we get up before the Bar of Justice time. So I called Herb again. The gracious all of Justice Herb. And he says, why aren't you at the country? I says, Herb, I'm over here at the other end of some bridge in a Shell station. Where is this place? And he says, what do you mean? I says, what's the name of the place? Where is the theater? What? You mean you don't know? I says, I don't, Herb. He says, when did I? He
says, don't leave the phone. I'll find out. So at that point, he hangs up. Now I'm standing in a Shell station next to a payphone, wearing a red tuxedo, and people keep driving in and looking at me. In those days, they had gas in Shell stations, you know, and people would come in. They drive in, and it was a little station made out of bricks, it looked like, and you can't hide, you know. I'm standing right above the grease pit, and this guy kept hollering out, will you get on the ball? I can't wait all day, you know. My wife's waiting for supper. Well, I'm standing there waiting, and then the phone rings.
Oh,
I pick up the phone. The guy says, is Ernie there? I says, well, wait a minute, I'll get Ernie. I says, are you Ernie? He says, yeah. He says, okay, tell him, is that Jaime? I says, are you Jaime? He says, yeah. I says, tell him to wait. Jaime, wait. And you know, it had a certain surreal quality to wearing that tuxedo answering the phone at a Shell station. Oh, God, you know. Well, Jaime and Ernie, they were on the phone about 20 minutes. And finally, Ernie hangs up and says, thanks for answering. If it calls back, tell him I'm gone. I said, okay. So I'm waiting more by the phone. By this time, he's used to me, you know. And he asked me if I want a cigarette, you know, when I'm eating a sandwich with him. So finally, the phone rings again, and it's Herb. Herb says, he says, okay, I got the place. He said, waiting for you. I said, all right, Herb, where is it? He says, well, it's the, wait a minute, I wrote it down here. It's the Little Bijou. He says, it's on East Queens Boulevard, just off 129th Street, between 129th and 138th Street. He says, under the L. I said, okay, Little Bijou, East Queens Boulevard, just off 129th Street. So I go back into the car. I says, take me to the Little Bijou, my good man. He's really bummed by this time. This guy's sitting there smoldering. Looks at me. He's been running out of the car every 5 minutes while he's been waiting, running across the street to a place called the Bluebird. He ain't been drinking Rheingold. I can tell. That's the start. Nor Kirsch. He comes back in, and he sits there, and he says, where do you want to go? I says, take me to the Little Bijou Theater. What the hell's that? I said, well, it's off East Queens Boulevard between 129th and 130th Street. It's under the L, stupid. And he says, okay, all right, I'll take it. He said, what's in it first? And we start going down the street. It's now, by the way, about 7:45. I was supposed to be there at 7. And have you ever been involved in something that has gone so disastrous that now you're beginning to enjoy it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just like guys get to enjoy wars after a while. You know, I'm sitting in the back seat, and I'm counting the gum wrappers, and we go up and down side streets. It's now 7:45, and sure enough, we finally pull up before one of the saddest little neighborhood theaters, and I'd been expecting something. I had the elegance, you know, the Roxy or something. Here's this little theater next to a meat market. And would you believe it or not, on the marquee, they had beauty contest tonight, and it says WNEW star Dick Shepherd appearing in person. Well, I knew it had to happen. And incidentally, this theater was so sad that the other side they shared with the meat market. It's the bacon, 79 cents a pound, you know, on the marquee. So I walk up to the lady, and said, there's a little old lady sitting in the box office. And I says, I'm Dick Shepherd from WNEW. By now, I'm going to go with it. So she says, oh, they've been waiting for you. And I said, yeah, well, all right. I says, what do you do? She says, well, we go right in. So I walk into the theater. And if I have ever seen a scene which haunts me, comes back, like have you ever had a bag of slightly bad potato chips? They tend to taste them for weeks. Well, this scene is like that. I walked into the theater, and you know, these old theaters have a real smell to them. I mean, the seats are thick with ancient gum. I mean, there was gum in the bottom of those seats that had been chewed and popped by teenagers when Rudolph Valentino was taking a teen was screen test, you know. There it was. You could smell cigar butts and tennis shoes and everything, and I walk in this theater, and there's about, outside, maybe 75 people scattered around the house. And I'm wearing a tuxedo. And I stop by the door. There's a guy standing there taking tickets. I says, when is the beauty contest? He says, what do you want to know? You an inspector? I says, no, I'm not an inspector. I'm going to judge the beauty contest. Oh. He says, okay. He says, just a minute. He says, I'll get Al. I wait in the darkness, and I could see this flickering image on the screen. They were looking at an ancient Chester Morris movie or something up there. And I'm waiting, and the guy suddenly appears out of the darkness. He says, hey, you Shepherd? I says, yeah. He says, okay, let's go. He says, follow me. He grabs a hold of my coat, and we run through the darkness, and now we're backstage. Given the backstage of a neighborhood theater in Queens. Fantastic. Old battered popcorn machines are sitting back there, you know. Ancient stars of that theater, and there's about 9 girls waiting to go on. And I arrive with my tuxedo, and these girls are all nervous, and they're wearing bathing suits, you know, Alexander's Best. And they're all waiting, and I have never seen a collection. I formed an idea that night. The people who are drawn to beauty contests either are beauties or they're totally the opposite. It's just like, have you ever sat in at an announcer's audition? Well, out of 10 guys that walk in, 5 have pronounced speech defects. If you know such, I mean, really. I remember one guy auditioning in an audition that I sat in on for a staff announcer who was to do station breaks, and he couldn't pronounce W. I'm serious. He would say, Crowbow. The one thing an announcer has to say is W. He could say B or C, but he couldn't say W. He said, Crowbow. And the name of the station was WLW. Can you imagine this? So this is... Here's 2 short little fat girls who look like cantaloupes with feet. And there was another one that looked exactly like a hat rack. You've never seen a hat rack wearing Band-Aids, right? And you know, one was amazing. Well, one girl, did you ever read Dick Tracy?
Yeah.
One girl looked exactly like the mole. That a long, narrow face with a mustache on the head. And with that, Al walks out on the stage. He's got a checkered coat, and all of a sudden they turn the film off, and on comes the light, and he's out there with this double button carbon mic. Well, it's a collector's item, you know. He says, ladies and gentlemen, he says, time now for the first semifinal of our great beauty contest. We have beauties from all over Queens have assembled here tonight. And to judge, we have Dick Shepherd from WNEW. Who he is, Dick Shepherd?
And I walk out of the stage and you hear a murmur of angry muttering. You know?
And I walk back off the stage. And the other 2 guys are introduced. By the way, one of them was gone on to become one of the most famous talk shows. He was there, too, the 3 of us. All badly introduced. And Al says, okay, he says, now our guests are going to sit in the front row and are going to judge the beauties. So we sat down in the front with 3 of us wearing tuxedos. And with that, they put on a record. I mean, everything was done with exquisite slob taste. You know, that's a talent. I must say, Slav Art is a talent, and on through the PA system played on this crystal pickup, John, with fantastic hiss. It sounded like Wayne King. I mean, I thought Wayne King records had dissolved millions of years ago. On came Wayne King and his golden saxophone playing, "A Pretty Girl Is Like a Melody." And these nine girls walked out on the stage. Again, the Slav Art technique was at its fullest. They had a lime green light. This is the very light that Bela Lugosi used in playing Dracula to such effect. And these girls came out, they looked unbelievable. They looked like, you know, that they had been resurrected. And there they were on the stage. With that, the audience starts to holler, "Woo!" And I was sitting there, and these poor girls were walking back and forth, and Al says, "Now, here is Carmelita Glockenspiel, 129th Street and 4th Avenue. Give Carmelita a big hand." And about three guys clapping. I'm sitting down here, and we're supposed to be making notes. And I turned to the guy next to me, who was, as I said, now a famous...
You don't want to mention
names. I do not want to mention names. I says, "Johnny," he says, "Yeah." I says, "How the hell do we get out of this?" He says, "I know what I'm going to do." He says, "I'm going to fill out the form and run like hell." I says, "That's what I'm going to do, too." And so we sat there we, in the darkness. We're filling out our forms. It was academic as to who was the most beautiful. You know, I said, "Hey, Johnny, I'm going to vote for a hat rack." He says, "I'm going all the way with the alligator." So, we turned in our three ballots, and it was a dead heat between three people. The alligator, the mole, and the hat rat. So they went on into the semifinal. There was a great roar of applause. You know, the 75 assembled people back out in that 53 Dodge. And this time I'm with Johnny and with this other guy, a guy named Mel. We drove under the L, and we headed back to Manhattan. Dead silence. And I said to the guy who was driving, I says, "Wait a minute." I says, "I want to make a phone call. Stop right here at the Shell station." I walked in, and here's Ernie sitting there. He says, "Hey," he says, "how are you?" I says, "How was the wedding?" I said, "Went off fine." I said, "Let me use the phone again." So I called up Herb, and I said, "Herb?" He says, "Yeah." I said, "Herb," I said, "I did it." He says, "How was it? Was it exciting? Boy, you guys live a great life, watching all those girls and all that stuff." I said, "Herb, I'm going to send you out on the next one." I said, "I'll tell you one thing. The alligator won." So you'll be seeing her picture in the subways. Semi-final winner. I hung up. And I've never forgotten that night because it had so many elements of surreal Nathaniel West. And from that time on, Herb and I had never mentioned it.
Yeah.
All right. Oh, yeah. I'll never forget the time I was sent out. You go through some unbelievably embarrassing moments in showbiz. Like the night I was sent out, this was some time ago, to the opening of a supermarket out in Jersey. And I arrived. They told me, you know, they really want you out there and the whole thing. So I arrived out at the supermarket. Were you involved in that one, John?
Yes, I went.
And the guy didn't know who we were.
Yeah, well, we were out there. No, I went out with Mr. Salzman in his convertible. And I had a bar mitzvah suit on to make a good appearance. And so Salzman is confused. He's driving around, and they're constructing a new food fair store. The glass is in the windows, and shelves are being installed. And if we waited for the grand opening, it would have been about 6 weeks later. So he inquired, and we found out we were not coming to the grand opening of a supermarket. We were supposed to be at another food fair, which was like 2 miles down the line, that was celebrating their first anniversary. So we got to this shopping area, and I would say maybe there were about 30 or 40 cars there, but not for food fair. Possibly the manager of the food fair's car was there, and some of the other merchants who were opening their stores at that time. Well, I saw these big signs on the window, lamb chops, 79 cents a pound, and a couple of other things like that. I didn't notice anything about Long John appearing there in person. So now, Salton says, don't worry, it's all set.
It'll be a big deal.
Big, big reception, and I didn't want to make this scene at all. So now when we walk over to the entrance of the store, there's a little 8.5 by 11 card, which was an advertisement for something on one side, but they had turned it over so they had the back, and then crayon, they said, Long John will appear here Tuesday at 10 o'clock. It was the same type of sign that it gives you the manager's name in case of an emergency call. So I walk in, and there's about six women with shopping carts and curlers in their hairs, in their hair, and the manager is called, and he comes over, and he gives me a double warm handshake, both hands. He clasps my hand, and he shakes it graciously and firmly. And he said, we're really delighted to have you here. And he said, I was talking to my wife at dinner last night, and she was saying that you are so different from other broadcasters. Well, at least I knew I had one fan. And my wife said to me, your choice of music that you play on your show is so great. And my wife listens to you every night at 8 o'clock. Of course, I'm on at midnight and never played any music. It's a talk show. So now he tells me that I should walk around and talk to the people with their shopping cart. And Salzman is sort of hiding, you know, in the shadows of the door there because he knows we're really bombing out. Now, I said to Salzman, and I went to him, I said, what do you want me to say? He said, just say, I'm Long John. How are you? And I did this to about four women. And it didn't impress them at all. One woman asked me where the Les Toil was. You know, I guess she thought I was the new assistant manager or something. Now, when we're ready to leave, which was around 12 minutes later, the manager thanked me for helping to make this celebration of the first year that they've been in business a great success. And he had a little gift for me. And he said, I know you possibly enjoy great steaks. These are our best. And these are 98 cents a pound or something like that. And he had two steaks wrapped up, and I said, no, no, thank you. Salton said, I'll take them for you, John. And that was the end of our tour.
Well, you know, it's funny, Candy. I see this. I don't know whether you've ever had any of those fantastically humiliating things, but it isn't only in you might say broadcasting. It's all areas. Like last year, I was out in Albuquerque, and I was there for a specific reason, obviously, and I was with some people, and we went into a drive-in, mm-hmm. Like a McDonald's. And you know, there's people driving in and out. And I go into the McDonald's with the guy to get a couple of quarter pounders, and I see this guy sort of looking furtive, standing over in the corner there, saying, I walked over and got in line and waiting for the quarter pounders, and I turned to him. He looked for me, and I said, "Say, don't I know you?" And he said, "Well, I don't know." He looks away, and I says, "Of course." I says, "You're Anthony Quinn." I said, what the hell are you doing here? He said, well, I'm supposed to be signing autographs.
How he ever got sent to a McDonald's, I have no idea, but it was for some cockamamie movie that they were premiering there, and somebody got a half-baked idea that as Johnson's bombed out, and there he is, stuck. Well, then I'll add it to another one. One day I'm down in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Well, now, Fort Lauderdale is, have you ever been down there?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's a federal highway. It's a great big highway that runs right along through there. And
number one.
Yeah, it's a big highway, and I needed something for the car that I was driving. It was a great big discount house there. Like, it looked like, was Kmart. You remember the Kmart? These are big discount houses, gigantic buildings. They look like airplane hangars.
Mm-hmm.
And I go into this Kmart, 50 million cars in the driveway. And I walk into the place, and I go all the way in the back where they're selling tire jacks and, you know, stuff like that, you know, the lawnmower sharpeners and all kinds of junk back there. And they had sporting equipment, all of the people wandering around. And there's a guy standing next to the counter there. And he's just sort of standing, look kind of sheepish, you know, big, huge guy. And I walk up to him. And he says, do you like an autograph? I was going to ask him where the spark plugs were. I says, well, no, I hadn't come in for an autograph. I said, if you're giving them out, you know, what the hell, you know? Oh, yeah. He looks kind of sheepish. He says, what do you want me to autograph? I says, well, I don't care. You know, if I had a cast, you could autograph that. But he says, but what do you got? I said, well, I had a paper, the Fort Lauderdale News. And so I said, yeah, you autograph this. He signed. So he writes down Frank Howard, Washington Senators. You know, Frank Howard, the famous home run hitter. See? So I said, Frank Howard, you're Frank Howard. And he says, yeah. He said, they sent me over here to sign autographs. I says, but nobody's here. He says, why? He says, I'll only be here another half hour. And I says, oh, God, you know, it's a humiliation. Here's a guy, you know, the $100,000 a year ball player, and he's got to stand around in some discount house.
Mm. I had one experience at Bookmasters. Next to, I think it was the George M. Cohan Theater. And Bookmasters at that time was open all night. And the first book that I wrote was now out in paperback. And I was supposed to go there. Well, it was one of the worst snowstorms. In fact, it was so bad that they couldn't even keep the doors shut. And they had a card table there in the front. And I walked over there with, I don't know, Paris Flamand or somebody like that. And there's no one on the street, and there's no one in the store. But they have a tremendous supply of my new paperback, 6, which are there to be autographed. Well, I sat there freezing cold, and I have to get back to WOR, which is a short distance, but it would take a good 15 minutes to walk back because of the snowstorm. And eventually, a little elderly lady who should have never been out in that storm comes in. She didn't have to open the door. The wind did it for her. And I am sitting there freezing cold. Snow even on my card table by now that had drifted in. And she said, are you Long John? I said, yes, I am. It's the only person who came in and asked for me. They did have a rather small sign. It was larger than at the supermarket. It was about 11 by 14 stuck in the corner of the window. And she said, can I look at the book? And she did. I thought she was reading the entire book, but she didn't quite complete it. And I said, well, I have to leave. Do you want to get one? Do you want to autograph it? She said, no, I just wanted to see what you look like. And she thanked me very much, and she disappeared into the night out in a snowstorm. And I disappeared, and the manager, no one came over, no one said a word, and Paris and I, through the slushy snow and all, went back to WOR. Not one single autograph was given for one of the books.
Well, one time down in Richmond, Virginia, there was a book author dinner. You've heard of book author dinner.
Many of them.
Right. And at this particular one, Philip Wiley, the late Philip Wiley, was one of the authors. And the daughter of Marcus Child, whose first name I can't recall, but she had a book out. And myself were to appear in the local bookstore. And they had a big hoodinky before the dinner that night and a cocktail party and so forth. And we went in, and with the exception of the salespeople, no one. And they had signs. They had a great big tent sort of thing standing outside, a placard, you know, this type of thing. And I noticed that Phil Wiley sat down at a table, and we each had our own table with books piled up, and he sat down and immediately started writing, except there's nobody in the store, he's autographing. And I learned a lesson from that particular thing. Anytime you go into a store for an autographing party or a book appearance, you immediately sign. And I went over to see what he was writing because I couldn't see any people. There weren't any. He was writing Happy New Year, Merry Christmas, Happy Birthday, and he left space for the name of the person, Philip Wiley. Well, with the autograph in the book, the store cannot send the books back to the publisher.
Yeah, that's true. It's autograph stock, yeah.
So that we all got the same message, and we all sat there, and I think maybe there were three books sold, and I think they were Phil Wiley's the whole afternoon, but we signed those books fast and
well, I had a lot of good experiences, though, in book signings. I just had one. Yeah, I really had some big ones. I had, in fact, I remember probably the most successful book signing that I've ever been involved in was at Wanamaker's in Philadelphia. We had about...
I've done that one, too.
About 1,500 people there.
They have the lunch for you first.
Yeah.
Upstairs in the...
very well done.
Executive dining room.
That's right. I guess a lot of stores don't realize that, you have to produce a book signing just like you produce a show. You have to really put it on.
What's the fellow's name there? Weatherby?
Yeah, he's the manager.
Yeah, he's the man who handles a great man.
Right.
Handles
very bad,
very well.
If your publisher, and if the books come from the PR department, if someone in that department might happen to forget to send the books, it's rather embarrassing.
You know, that's one of the biggest problems today in publishing is distribution.
I believe that. I've had that happen time
and
again.
And it's a tough problem because all over the country, now Wanda Hickey has just come out in paperback, and Dell is one of the biggest paperback publishers. And yet, I get letters from people. I've gotten letters already saying, I live in X city, and they haven't got your book. They can't find it, and they never heard of it.
Think of going to a publishing party for your own book. I mean, an autograph party, and they don't even have the book.
That's happened to me. It happened to me in Seattle. We had a very bad situation where I was sent out to Seattle by Doubleday. This is when... In God We Trust came out. Now, that was a bestseller, Candy, on the bestseller list for, 17 weeks, national. And really legitimate. You know, every book today is called a bestseller. You pick up, every ad says the bestseller about to be published. They didn't call them bestsellers before they even know them. That's right. They say that. But actually, there's only a few books that actually make the national list. For example, Wanda Hickey here was on the Time Magazine bestseller list, which is a national list, one of the most difficult to make.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, I got out to... Here I was on the bestseller list at that time, but in God We Trust. We were already in our sixth or seventh edition. And I arrived out at the airport. It was a real strange moment. And this woman met me at the airport, and she said, I represent the University of Washington here. And she said, we were going to have a big party for you here. But we can't get any copies of your book. She says, I have the only copy in town. And I said, where'd you get it?
you, so we had to go to Portland to get it. And so we went to the TV station. I was on the bird on TV. And here I was being interviewed by a guy on an hour show. Very embarrassing. He didn't have a copy of the book. Mm. And I wonder how many people realize that books are difficult to distribute. And in fact, one of the reasons is that most bookstores today are in the Snoopy sweatshirt business.
Mm-hmm.
The books are a sideline now in most books.
And posters.
Posters, they sell Lucy note paper.
Calendars.
Charles Schulz is an entire industry now. He's taken over, way in the back in the book department, after you pass the Big Daddy Banana Big Pens and stuff, you may find a few symbolic books.
One thing is that, are you doing something?
I do have to. I'm a little late on that.
Okay.
And we are back here again. This is the Long John Neville Candy Jones Show, and our guest tonight is Gene Shepherd.
You know, I really enjoy this, John. I like to just sit around and, as you say, cut up a melon.
That's right.
This kind of radio is, to me, very attractive. Mm-hmm. And I think the listeners like it, too.
We enjoy it very, very much. I think after a little while, we will open the phones for...
Do you slice up any melons anymore these days?
Yeah, we cut up a few jackpots. like last night, this man, Nick Kendall. Kendall, rather, who was doing a story, was just sitting here. He had been interviewing me for, I guess, some 20 or 30 minutes before. And we had Bob Carson on and David Schulte. And somehow there was an opportunity to throw him in an empty chair. And he participated and kind of enjoyed it and got a little feeling of a taste of the flavor of the show, which is pretty hard to get if you're sitting on the sideline or listening at home. You really don't know what happens and how the whole thing goes. Yes.
But he had said he had been a broadcaster and
in the Orient.
Yeah.
Yes. He had been for 12 years in the Orient.
No, in Hong Kong.
Well,
excuse me, yes. I had just said in Japan, but it was in Hong Kong.
John, have you worked the Buddha Gaff recently?
No, I haven't for a number of years. My last appearance was in Hammond, Indiana.
Have you used the Punkum Gaff at all?
No. Flukum.
Flukum.
No. No, I've...
Know that John invented a razor sharpener?
A razor sharpener?
Yes, he did. There was a moment when it was Tap City with John. And as you know, John is a man of exceeding resources.
Right.
Fantastic. Trapping John is about like trapping a water rat. He can swim, he can run, he can bite, he can do anything. And John was Tap City in a second-rate hotel here in New York. And really down on his luck.
Fourth-rate
hotel.
I gradually worked up to the second.
He was wearing the Daily News editorial page as the soles of his shoes. And he's sitting there right up against the wall, and he's looking bleakly around the room, trying to figure out how he can eke a dollar out of this world. And he notices hanging in the closet some empty coat hangers.
Wire coat hangers.
Empty wire coat hangers. And, of course, that's about all John ever had in his closets in those days. And he got an idea. So he went downstairs, and he had maybe 35 cents in his pocket. Went down to one of these places where they sell all kinds of novelties and so on, and he bought himself a bag of marbles. Marbles, glass marbles. And he came back to the hotel room with a pair of pliers, and 15 minutes later, John had created 25 razor sharpeners using bent wire coat hangers and marbles. And he's down on 14th Street hawking them at a dollar a clip. And within 25 minutes, John has made $74.
packed his little bag and departed for Charleston, West Virginia. I'm telling you the truth.
But how did the marble thing
work? Well, John took two marbles. He took two marbles, and you take the wire coat hanger, and you make two little hooks like circles, see, and you fit the marbles in together so the marbles are just touching.
Yeah.
And the coat hangers hold them together.
Yeah.
At which point, then you take a double-edged razor blade and you run it between the marbles.
And it works?
You're darn right it works.
I'll be darned.
The police department took a dim view of it.
He had many friends. I've heard about the mendicant squad. He had many friends in the mendicant squad.
They come in here occasionally today and see whether John is running a gap.
They come in as a guest.
The idea of John sitting in a hotel room dreaming up a concept like that, you know.
Fantastic.
Oh, yeah, and then the time John invented the... did he ever tell you about the time he invented the beauty cream?
The beauty cream, no.
Oh, yeah.
I wish he had. I'd like to use it.
Well, you wouldn't exactly like to use this beauty cream, but it turned a nice buck for John, and he, again, it was a hotel room situation that developed outside of Atlantic City. And John is sitting there, and it was Tap City. There it is. John brought in one of his. There he brought one of them in.
I've never seen it.
Well, I had to get. If I couldn't have found it, I'd have been disappointed.
Fantastic, John.
Actually, what happened was a lady who was a fan of the show, as a joke, sent it back to me for a refund. She realized
it's a lifetime guarantee John offered this.
That's right.
Yeah.
So the outcome of it is I sent her my check for 25 cents, and I understand she has it framed.
Isn't that something?
Now, eventually, I had a patent pending on it, and then I went to a wire company and had them make it. I used to do this by hand, twisting this with a long-nosed plier. And, of course, I hadn't selected the marbles. I'd just buy a bag of marbles.
Yeah, they come in any color.
Yeah, and so they were a mixture. Then when you get a real tough day, you would work some for a half a dollar by selecting the color of the marbles. This is for super sharp.
The green ones were they were the ones that
really did. That's right, that's right. There it is.
Oh, my, there is such a thing, and it's beautiful.
We're not kidding you, Candy.
No, these are not stars.
And
these are not apocryphal, are they, Jim?
No, they're all based on fact. And I was fiddling around trying to figure how. Then I made a form. I think it was a piece of 2x4, and I can't think of the type of the nail. It doesn't have a head on, headless nail. Finishing nails, right?
Yeah, finishing nails.
Finishing
right.
Nails. So I got, I forget what pound weight, whether they were 10 penny or what, but they had to be strong. And I made a design, and I would put my wire, and of course I didn't have money for wire after I made my first one, so I had to take... The wire that I had, and that's pretty tough to bend.
That's coat hanger.
The coat hanger wire. So then I would start it like here, I forget, and then I would follow around and bend it around these very, maybe I'm wrong when I say 10 penny, but they were real heavy finishing nails, so I could slip the whole thing off. Now, if it had a head, I'd have to bend it out of shape again and put it back in shape. And, I used to make these and knock out maybe at night about maybe 24. That's all I could produce. And
assembly line up in the hotel room number 12.
That's right, in the old Carmack Hotel. It was a great place. They had hot and cold running water, and you were very fortunate because you would always have cold water out of both faucets. But in order, of course, if you were washing your hands, you would always use the one marked H because it gave you a sensation that it was, but it wasn't. It was just the same water. I'd wash my hands.
We're up here at this moment.
Then rinse with cold water.
Candy, you know, you strike me as a girl who's lived a somewhat elegant life. And I can only say that living as John has done and as I have done
in a two-bit theatrical hotel in the Times Square area for roughly a year will teach you more than you can learn in all the combined universities of the world. I remember living in a hotel room for one solid year on 49th Street that had been painted so many times with this battleship gray paint that the walls were like 4 or 5 inches closer to you, just because, and you could see they'd even painted over a dead bat and stuff. Yeah, I'm telling you, unbelievable. I'm telling you the truth. And hanging in the middle of the room was a green cord with a yellow light bulb. That was my entire illumination. Yeah. And there was a window. I had a window, but the window was permanently sealed by like 200 years of accumulated dust and crud and God knows what, paint and everything else. And the window was a curious color gray, and it looked out into the air shaft. And at nights, I was really tap city, as John says. I can remember one night going down to the, you know, that drugstore at 49th and, is it, no, it's 50th and Broad.
The Grays?
No, Walgreens.
No, Grays was down around. Walgreens was there. Yeah, Walgreens, yeah.
And I walked into Walgreens one night. I was so down that I walked in there and I stood in front of the candy counter, and I had a long debate. There were candy bars for 6 cents and they had candy bars for 10 cents, and I was debating whether or not, what the hell, it was Thanksgiving, go all the way, get a 10 cent. I'm serious. And I bought a 10 cent candy bar, and I remember coming back to that room and looking through this gray glass, and you saw nothing but this damn airship. There was never any, it was not, never daytime, never night there. It was always this gray color. And once in a while, something would whistle past the window. Something going down in the edge of the air.
What was it?
A beer can or a hand grenade or something going past. And it would land down, and down at the bottom of the air shaft was this accumulated midden heap. You know, an archaeological term that had been started about the time of Diamond Jim Brady. And it was thick, you know. I often wondered if you could just cut this midden heap right in half, you know. And you could trace the whole ages of the American theater right from the, you know, one of Lillian Russell's slippers still smelling of champagne, and down in the bottom and all the way at the top. And once in a while, strange things would go through this air shop. And I'm sitting there one night, and it was about maybe about 11, 12 o'clock at night, midnight. And that was academic. It was never, you know, night, day was all the same. Well, all of a sudden I hear, whoop, whoop, whoop. Yeah, this was a new sound. There were other sounds that were going on constantly in the halls there, you know. You'd hear the sound of the thud of a blackjack occasionally. Yeah, you really would. And then you'd hear the mysterious scuffle. Occasional cryings in the hall, you know, people. Yeah, you were anyway. You hear a muffled scream. You've been in places like that, Jack. Mm-hmm. And you know, you mind your own counsels. But I heard this oop, oop, oop.
What was it?
Well, that was the question that occurred to me. What was it? See, so I walk out in the hall, I look up and down. It's dark. These halls, but it was totally dark. They had one little red light bulb down at the other end.
It was the fire exit.
The fire exit was academic. It was painted on the wall. If there was ever a fire in there, you went with the car.
There was no door or anything.
No. Just had the bulb down there. So I hear, oop, oop. So I go downstairs. See, I go down to the desk, and here's Jimmy sitting at the desk. There's always a guy that's been there for, you know, 100 years. He sells everything. I mean, once you get to be a regular, you can buy anything. You know, Arabian slave girls, whatever you want. You know, Jimmy's got it. See, so I said to Jimmy, I said, Jimmy. He said, yes. I said, I'm on the second floor there. I said, there's something in the hall. It's going, oop. He said, oh, that's Oliver. I said, Oliver? He says, yeah. He says, he lets them out usually about this time of the night. And I says, well, what's that work? He says, well, go back up there. And he says, and go pass from 202 and knock on the door. And you're at him. So I says, okay. So I go back up to 202 and knock on the door. The door opens a little cracks. And the guy looks at me. He says, what do you want? I says, are you Oliver? He says, yeah, what do you want? I says, well, I'm down here at 212. He says, yeah, what do you want? And all of a sudden, I hear back of him, oop, oop. I says, what's the oop, oop? He says, well, that's Jimmy and Fred. I says, Jimmy and Fred? He says, yeah, come on in. He was living with his two seals. He had two trained seals. And
out of work act.
He's an out of work act, and he's got his two seals. See, and at 2 o'clock in the morning, he would sneak down to the cafeteria and steal old cabbages and bring them back up and eat them. See, so these two seals, about once or twice a week, they would practice. And the seals would play Columbia, the Gemini Ocean.
Your horn.
That's right. And they'd go, boop, 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 boop. And then once in a while, so one weekend, I sat with Jimmy and Fred. Well, Oliver went up to the country to visit his sister. And I babysat the seals. So, you know, you're worrying about life. I mean, it's the kind of stuff Johnny Carson doesn't know.
You know, have
you agree, John?
Oh, yes. You know, actually, the Kermack Hotel, when I was at the Paramount Theater, the Kermack must have been a pretty good, let's say, second-rate or transient hotel at one time, because they had a magnificent big room downstairs that had been an elegant dining room with mirrors on the wall. And how I became acquainted with it was a guy by the name of Buster Holt, who was a doorman at the Paramount Theater. And he told me that his buddy, who was living with them, they both came out of some small community in Massachusetts, a fellow by the name of Ken Bilson, was practicing banjo. So I, in turn, met this man. Of course, the hotel was really right down at the bottom at the time. So we got permission to use that dining room, which was closed off to everybody, but we had heard about it. And we could work doing this dance routine and playing banjos in front of the mirror. So we could practice. It was a great floor. It had a lot of spring in it, and you could get the double and triple taps and things like that. It was just marvelous. And, of course, we had planned to appear at the Palace Theater in its heyday. We didn't. We just continued to sit week after week in the balcony for 35 cents. But we had really planned, although the management of the Palace were unaware of our plans and so naturally never negotiated the contract with us.
Just a matter.
That's right. A lack of communications, and so we didn't do it. Did you ever hear the story about Ken Bilson and what was the name of the great dancers at the Capitol Theater and who was the man who was the choreographer?
Tower Champion?
No. Another great name. Gee, I hope somebody will tell me. Nevertheless, what happened was this. It was a gentleman by the name of Mr. Simmons. Some people, because he sort of a motherly type, a very nice man, and they used to call him Ma Simmons, and he was the casting director for the Schubert Theater, for the Schubert musical comedies, and he was really a delightful man, no two ways about it.
Why didn't they go and talk to him?
I don't know, just they had an affection for the man. So nevertheless, there was a call on Saturday. Now, Bilson ran scared. Bilson was a guy who was hungry. He was working for Western Electric. And as I told you, I went to his farewell party. I was the surprise guest out there. And the guy had tears when he saw me walk in. They had a big, big affair for him. Don Bain went out with me, too, out in Whippany, New Jersey, when he retired. So he always had the ambition, but he ran a little scared. Maybe he was right, because today he's retired, living in Florida or someplace, and he hasn't got a care in the world, so maybe he's better off. Nevertheless, this is a hot Saturday afternoon, and there's a call at the Schubert Theater for chorus people. And he really was hungry for show business. And I said, you want to go over with me? And he did. He wouldn't get in the line or anything like that, and I did a time step and a break or something like that. And Mr. Schubert pointed to me, and they got my name, and another fella, too. This was not for the course. This was for something special, which I had no idea what it was. So there's another call next Wednesday. In the meantime, Mr. Simmons said to me and this other fella, I want you to go over, I can't think of their name. They used to be in where the Ed Sullivan Theater is today, on the second floor. And he said, I want you to go over this afternoon about 2:00, and the two of you in this particular musical comedy play, I have no idea what it was, you are going to do some ballet in the devil's costume. Well, of course, I knew nothing about ballet. This was not for me at all. Well, as we left the theater, the other guy said, I don't know anything about ballet. I said, I don't. Chester Hale. You remember the Chester Hale girls? Oh, man alive. That was one of the big...
drew a blank from both of us.
Choreographers. He was great. The Chester Hale girls. So, this guy backed out. He didn't know ballet. I didn't either, but I wasn't going to admit it.
Really, to work at ballet.
I'm willing to try.
Guy says, let's take the first course of Swan Lake. You got over there in the glasses. I want you to...
So, we went over to... And we're in our shirt sleeves and pair of slacks. And so we got over there, and there's somebody thumping away on the piano, and the girls are in the rehearsal clothes, and they're doing these numbers and these routines for next week at the Capitol Theater. So Mr. Hale blew his whistle or something to stop the rehearsal, and the girls plunk on the floor and just sit there. And he says, yes, may I help you? And, of course, I'm the talker. Now, the other guy didn't go with me. So I said to Ken Bilson, who was about my height and about my build, I said, you come with me. I don't know ballet. And I know, you know some of the steps off to Buffalo, time step break and a few other things and a hero.
Famous ballet steps, yeah.
So, Chester Hale was a very nice guy.
Instead of Nurin Yap doing an off to Buffalo.
Do you have rehearsal clothes? I said, no. He said, you got shorts on? I said, yeah. He says, go in there and take off your clothes and come out here just in your shorts. It's all right. And, of course, that was nothing embarrassing to me. So we went back, and, of course, I'm off with my trousers and no time flat. Left my socks on and my shoes. And Bilson is a slow undresser or dresser. All of a sudden, he is now doing, I don't know any of the names of ballet steps, but he is going up in the air and coming down. He says, try that. Well, I was up in the air, and I didn't come down with any grace. He said, you can make it. He called me right away by my first name, Jack. You can't miss. All of a sudden, I heard a tremendous amount of laughter. Now, if it came from my retarded ballet knowledge, I could have understood it. But what happens, it is Bilson. Now, Bilson is a slow guy with a buck. He hasn't got shorts. He is still wearing winter trousers, winter underwear. With the back flap on the back. And as he walks across the floor, It sounded like a bomb had dropped. A button came off. And you hear this button bouncing across the floor. Well, to make a long story short, Bilson ran out when he realized he didn't even think about the fact that he had long underwear on. The girls there.
Oh, cheering the boys.
It was just such a funny sight. And he asked me to come back, I don't know, Wednesday, and they're going to get another guy, and I'd have the part. And I didn't. However,
why not?
About maybe 7 or 8 years ago, I told this on the story, and I was absolutely thrilled. I got a letter from Chester Hale, now retired. And in his last paragraph, he said, if you want to come up Wednesday,
try again. I'll try.
That's beautiful.
Lovely.
Yes. Since we're doing Copelia.
Well, you know, Candy Jones was in Polonaise and Mexican Hayride.
Oh, sure.
But she wasn't in staying at the Kermack Hotel.
Well, see, we were in the seedier end of show business, the sweaty end. I'll never forget one night, you know, John mentioning that whole thing of the guy coming out doing the ballet in his long underwear. I was in a Broadway show, Candy, and I'll never forget the bit that I did. It was a very complex review. Had about 50 costume changes, and they were one-minute blackout things, like 30-second blackouts. It was produced by Leonard Selman.
New Faces?
Well, this was one of the New Faces. In fact, this was New Faces of 1961, as a matter of fact. We opened at the O'Keefe Theater in Toronto. It's a great, big, fantastic house, 4,000 people. And I had drawn a very curious assignment. I did a one-minute blackout where I sang, but I was wheeled out on the stage. They had a cable, so it was in the dark. And they pulled this thing out. Well, I was on a little platform that was painted gold. Little low platform with little tiny wheels under it. It was about 2 feet by 3 feet. And coming out of the middle of it was a golden tree. That was gold. And had gold leaves above my head with a golden apple. Well, there I was under this tree. But I was dressed in a flesh-tight body costume.
Bodysuit, yeah.
Bodysuit, see. And it was, well, actually what it was glorified long underwear, John. Yeah. But very, very, very tight. Very, very. And I was intertwined with this most unbelievably zoptic girl. Fantastic girl. I wish I could remember her name now. She was in the show, and she was a classic showgirl. I mean, she looked like about 14 watermelons having a fight. She was a lot of girl. And we were wheeled out, and suddenly the light would go on us. See, the people didn't notice. The light would go on us. We'd never done this bit yet in public. I was supposed to be Adam, and she was Eve. And she also was in a body costume with a fig leaf. Well, I didn't have a fig leaf. I was supposed to be Adam, and she was Eve. And she also was in a body costume with a fig leaf. Well, I didn't have a fig leaf. And so they pull us out there, and I remember we were backstage, we're getting on this thing. So we'd never seen it before, because they just had delivered it that afternoon. So we'd been rehearsing, but walking through it. See, so here, this first time we saw the cart. Well, a cart is about half the size it should have been. So there's only one way we could get on this cart together, the two of us. See, we're all intertwined, fantastic scene. They pull us out like that, and the light goes on. This bright spotlight picks us up, and here we are in Toronto, 4,500 people, and you hear this gasp. It's like a sudden, unbelievable obscenity has occurred on stage. Well, I started to sing, and the place is in an uproar. It was the first true porny has hit the Broadway stage. I mean, it preceded Old Calcutta, and made Old Calcutta look like a oral tooth hygiene pageant thing. And it pulled us out, and
And she says, I could hear her. See, she's sort of facing me, and her back is to the audience in this fantastic tight suit. And I am all intertwined, and the light goes on, and I start to sing. Well, the guy is in the orchestra pit directing the orchestra. We had about a 100-piece orchestra, and it was the same guy that had directed West Side Story. Very fine conductor. His name is Abba... Oh, I can't think of his last name. Abba something, but he was a top Broadway conductor. He gives a downbeat, and I was supposed to sing. See, I was supposed to sing this song about Adam and the apple and the Eve and all that stuff. And at that point, he looks up and he sees this apparition. I am wearing a pink bodysuit. Her bodysuit was a curious off-green color. We're under this gold tree, and it's an exercise in slob art, for starters. He gives it and starts to laugh. Well, at that point, the French horn player looks back, and he sees this thing. He starts to laugh, and I hear somebody, quick, the curtain! They pull the curtain down, and he drags it off. That thing never appeared again in the show. and nobody knows what the heck it was. See, so the reviewer that night, he says the funniest. He writes this review and says, by the way, blasted hell out of the show. And, this is an unbelievable turkey. So he blasts the show, but he says, however, there was one bright moment. This is an enigmatic skit when two people suddenly appeared on stage in what appeared to be a lewd embrace. when John tells me that story about the guy with the underwear, I keep thinking of that scene. And then there was another scene. You know, people never see the background of show business. Right. Here we are, we're out on the road. And desperately rehearsing all day long, all night long. It's about a $4 million show, you know. Oh, we have sets and costumes and everything else. And it was one incomprehensible skit where I played an Episcopalian bishop. And there were four of us on stage. One guy played the Greek patriarch of a church. Another guy played a cardinal. And there was a guy playing some high prolet of an obscure church. And I remember being down in my dressing room that night. I could hear, they had a little monitor speaker, see where the show was going on, see, and I'm frantically trying to put on my bishop costume, which I had never seen before. Now, I don't know whether you know anything about it. It's got a dickie. Mm-hmm. You know, you've seen the dickie thing. I'm trying to hook the dickie in the back. I have 12 seconds to change my costume. I'm changing from a caveman, by the way, into this, you know, this bishop costume. And we were to sing this song. It was a Gregorian chant we were singing. And I'm frantically, this is a mad thing. And I'm putting on this bishop costume, and I can hear the footsteps of the guy that shared the dressing room. He's running like mad. He's just finished his bit, see. And I can hear him running like crazy. He's going to change his costume. Boop, 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 boop. I hear feet. He comes roaring into the dressing room. And he's wearing a funny little derby, you see, with a red rubber nose. And he's laughing like hell. I says, Joey, what's the matter? Help me with my bishop suit. And he's putting my bishop suit. He says, Shepherd. And I says, yeah, Joey. He says, we're in a turkey. He said, my God, we're in a turkey. And I said, yeah, I know, Joey. And I ran back out. And I remember going out on stage, and we're singing this thing, and there were four of us under the light singing this song. And it was something called it was based on a Gregorian chant. And it was about the Ecumenical Council. How's that for an obscure piece of humor, see? And I'm singing, oh, I believe in all the bishops. And then all of a sudden, the curtain comes down right in the middle of all of us. And the cardinal says, my God, get out of the way. It's going to kill all of us. And the curtain comes down. And that, the next day, the review came out, and he says, just in the nick of time, one unbelievably bad skit was stopped by an unfortunate miscue in the curtain department. So if it had gone on another 30 seconds, a riot might have broken out last night in the O'Keefe.
Beautiful.
These are real, you know. John, I'm sorry.
Sorry of what? That those days are over?
No, not at all. I'm just sorry that we got off on that curious
Oh,
no, nothing wrong with that. That's good.
Could
That's
I tell
great.
You one curious?
Yes.
I don't know. It isn't anything such as your curiosity. But in Polonaise, which was a musical, the life of Chopin,
yeah.
Right? Marvelous music. Marta Eggers and Jan Kiopora. Oh. And I understand that Jan Kiopora Jr. is now singing. He's inherited his father's voice. Well, I played a stuttering princess, and I had a small part. It was a
part. You wore dirndls?
Hoop skirts.
Hoop skirts. Huh?
Yes. Right. There was one scene with it, as a matter of fact, with a dirndl, but there, yeah. I was as the princess Irene, and I wore platform sole shoes with heels about like this, is about 4 inches, so that I was tottering 6'2" or at least. And the comedian in the show was Kurt Bois. I don't know if you remember the name, B-O-I-S. Maybe he was 5'4". And at one point in the show, he had to be on stage. And you couldn't see him come on stage. And the way he would come on stage would be he'd get under my hoop skirt.
Uh-huh.
And I'd kind of come out and I would do my thing. And all this time, he would be under my hoop skirt in the back. Except he was ill. He had the flu. And the understudy for that part was about 5'11". Nobody ever thought about this.
As he comes out.
And so it was time, and I was so in the habit of, and these things were heavy, you know, the skirts, and when you would do a curtsy.
You got to tell the audience that Candy is now demonstrating. She's going into the second act of Polonaise now, scene two. Yes, go ahead.
But the hoop skirts were very, very heavy, and they would hang up, and every girl had a dresser, every girl who wore a costume such as this. And I would say they probably weighed about 30, 35 pounds. And when you would get down and come up, there would be a suction under the floor, and we all developed marvelous thigh muscles from it. But besides that, I would know that Kurt would be over there, and I'd just go over and lift my skirt up and get under. But I had never really thought about his understudy because the man had never been ill before. And this baritone got under the skirt. And I'll never forget going out on stage and there was something wrong. And he'd never been under my skirt before, of course, which sounds weird, but anyway, to make a long story short. We got out and it was a disastrous scene, and his feet were showing, I understand, and the audience seemed to be screaming with laughter, and he didn't know exactly how to walk under my skirt. And I never could figure, in fact, it wasn't until after that show that night that I wondered how Kurt did walk out. Well, I asked him later, he always walked out backwards. Because he's a very modest man.
I don't like that. That's this, style.
This fellow, I remember thinking, this felt so strange. And he didn't know exactly what to do with himself under the back of the skirt. And that's the end of the story.
Hey, well, that must have been a heck of a scene from the audience. So.
It must have been.
Well, I'll tell you, the things that happen in costume dramas like that are wild. I remember one scene where, again, in that same show, we rehearsed this show. It was directed by Ronnie Graham.
Oh, yes.
And we rehearsed it for about, it seemed like a year. And we finally went out on the road, and of course all the costumes came together, and everything was fantastic confusion with the costumes. And there was one sequence where I played don't ask me why, it was a 1 second black, I can't even remember the scenes, but I played a 4-star general. So I got the coat on, and the lights are changing, the cues are coming, the curtain goes up. There I am standing out there, and I'm wearing a 4-star general uniform, and the bottom half I hadn't gotten changed yet. And the lights went on, and they caught me, and I had half a George Washington suit on. And there I was out there with
shoes with buckles, with these blue velvet pants, you know, with the high white. Now, don't ask me why I was dressed as George Washington. It's a whole other scene. And this was in New Haven, and I remember the critic in New Haven said, in one scene, Mr. Shepard's costume was an amazing amalgam. Said that he was wearing the bottom half of a Revolutionary War general and the top half of what looked like Curtis LeMay's suit. And it was such a hit, they kept it in.
You know, this is my final little thing about, this was in Polonaise, too. There was one scene in which the palace had been overtaken by the peasants, and the revolution had come, and they had killed everyone. Excuse me. And I was supposed to have gone off stage. I was part of the family, the royal family, and we were all beheaded. We had all been murdered, and we were pulled off stage. However, the same hoop skirt caught on a prop. And the men, and I'm tugging away, and I couldn't get off, and they were pulling me, and I couldn't get off. It was a matinee, thank goodness. And the next person to come on stage said, and now that they are all gone, and you can see me completely, I'm still on stage, and we're ripping the skirt as best we can.
Well, the royal families don't give up easily.
No, they didn't.
So that when you're telling me the story of Polonaise, that reminds me of the kind of the plot that you're describing. The peasants have attacked the palace, and the princesses are fleeing, and then the poop skirts. It reminds me of the kind of thing that S.J. Perlman would write when he's writing a typical schlock opera. You know,
<That's> right.
The life of Chopin. That somehow, you know, it has all the elements of that.
Well, they popularized, of course, Chopin and Till the End of Time.
How did they handle George Sand?
She wasn't in it.
I would imagine.
I mean, she wasn't, you know, the whole...
They didn't cover the
affair. No, not at all.
Reminds me of Springtime for Hitler.
One of the most beautiful titles I've ever heard. Did you see that?
No, I did not. Oh, John.
Did you love that?
Well, listen, I knew the beginning of that production. Oh, really? In fact, I remember one night Mel Brooks were talking about.
Yeah.
Well, in those days when I was doing all his reviews, and I used to hang around a lot with Mel and all those guys, and I knew Mel Brooks, man, Bancroft, and the whole crowd. And this, by the way, he wrote this about a real producer, you know. You know, the character.
I didn't know that.
Well, we were sitting one night, yeah, and I knew the producer, too. I had worked for the same producer, so he and I had certain things in common. So we both knew this evil man. And so, yeah, Mel said, one night we're sitting, we were in the turf, as a matter of fact. You remember the turf?
Yes, surely.
So we're sitting in the turf, and it was a whole bunch of myself and Milton Kamen and all the comics who were working at the time around town used to always hang around there, either that or we'd go to Lindy's. And in this particular night, I was down there, and we were sitting there eating cheesecake, and I had just finished a hellish session with this same producer, who, by the way, later turned out to be the character that Zero Mostel played. I'm telling you, this is a real character. So, and this is how it came up. I'm sitting there, and we just had an unbelievably rotten rehearsal. This madman, this insane producer. And by the way, he's exactly the way Mostel played it. I'm trying to tell you, that's a real character. So,
right, I'm going to ask you later.
Well, when we get off the air.
Right,
so.
Exactly.
He's probably listening right now. So I was sitting at the end of the table, so in comes Mel. Looking real mad. See, he's had a bad day, too, see, somewhere. And so Mel comes in there, and he was with somebody else. And I don't know where Anne Bancroft was down the street in a show, in a play. I think she was in, what was she in at that time? I think the Miracle Night Worker. The time. And so he sits down, and he said something, and Milt came and said something, and it came around to me. Everybody was throwing in one-liners, and I said I'm going to tell you I want to lay a real obscenity on you guys. And so Mel looks over at me. He says, listen, he says, I've seen them all today, you can't top anything. I said, all right, I'll give you an obscenity. C.L. Bullard,
That's a nom de plume. See, I said, that's the name of the producer. He says, you're working for him? And I said, yeah. He says, I spent 12 years, the worst week in my life, working for him. And I says, yes, indeed, I know what you mean. And he says, you know, he says, one day I'm going to get back at that guy. He says, I'm going to write a show about him. He says, people won't believe it. They think it's fictional. I said, that's right. Now, he says, you know, he says, I'm going to have him producing a play called Springtime for Hitler. He says, he would bruise. He says, if I went in tonight and brought him a script, says, Springtime for Hitler, he'd say, great, now let's put it on. And so we're sitting there laughing, and we exchanged stories about this madman for about 3 hours. All of us had our moments with this guy. So about 3 or 4 years later, I'm walking along Lexington Avenue. And this was in the 50s. It was about 3 in the morning. And I had just come out of the Waldorf. I don't know what the devil, some strange show that I'd emceed there. And I'm walking down the street, and along comes Mel and Ann Bancroft. And I says, Mel. And he says, you know, by this time he's been out on the coast all the time. See, and I says, Mel, what are you doing in New York? She wouldn't guess. I says, what, Mel? He says, I did it. He says, where'd you see it? He says, I just finished it. I says, what? He says, Springtime for Hitler. And sure enough, when the picture came out, you know, and I'm just curious how many people who watched that, who reviewed it, I'm talking about serious reviewers in town, who had no idea, or who didn't know that it was about a real guy.
I never did.
Oh, yeah. In fact, this guy, seriously, this producer made...
Don't identify.
I won't. He made a career out of flops. He discovered he could make more money with flops. And he had his aunt and his sister and his grandmother, everybody on the payroll, you know, and they had one flop after the other. And
that was a great play.
Al Lottman's name.
No. No.
Zero will go after him, right?
But Mel, that was a great period right there at that time, because, you know, in those days, and that isn't that long ago, all the people who were involved in humor or comic work of any kind at all used to hang around mostly on 7th Avenue. And there was a drugstore at the corner of 50th and 7th.
Hanson's.
We used to all sit in that place, and all kinds of guys, some made it and some didn't. And we were all working humor at the time. Comedy, whatever you care to call it, and people like old Milk Kamen, this was Sandy Baron used to come in there, and of course...
Whatever happened to Sandy? Have they found him yet?
Well, I heard, I read in the paper that he's living in an apartment here in some friend's house or something, and I guess they found
him. He wasn't killed.
No, he called his agent today and said he's okay, he's in seclusion.
Because of the breakup of the...
I don't know. Just enigmatic. It's hard to know. But, in fact, at that time, I got to know Lenny Bruce. I knew Lenny at the time. There were a lot of people working in town that you don't hear much about anyway.
Oh, Jay Burton.
Yeah, sure. Why do you bring him up?
Oh, I thought he was one of the funniest men I'd ever met.
Yeah, I knew him, sort of.
Comedy writer.
I didn't know him because most of us were performers. In fact, I was in a review at a place called Down in the Depths. Do you recall that place?
No, I don't.
It was in the Hotel Duane. It was a nightclub, 37th and Madison. That's
yeah,
right.
Sure.
And it was a very chic place. It ran for...
Next to the Midston House.
Correct. And it was downstairs, and it was a very, very in place to go. And it was an elegant review there. Good ones. So we had a nice little review called Small Tacular, and it was a kind of a takeoff on they used to have things on TV called spectaculars. Remember when they had a spectacular?
Mm-hmm.
And this was a takeoff on that. And I was let's see who else was in that. Dorothy Love. Do you know the name Dorothy Love?
Yes.
Dorothy and I played a lot of scenes in that. I'll never forget. I still remember some of the lines of the scene Dorothy and I played. And, yeah, it's funny how these things stick in your mind. And a lot of the sketches in that review were written by Woody Allen, who was not a performer in those days. He was just, you know, writing sketches. And I remember that one particular skit, beautiful little skit that had appeared earlier on Broadway and was now in this production. You might have seen it. I was a guy sitting at a coffee table, a counter, in a coffee shop, mm-hmm. looking out at the audience, and just sitting there. And the guy behind the counter, whose back is to the audience, he's wearing a white cap, you know, he's obviously the counter man. He comes over and says, "What do you have?" And I said, "I have coffee, black." He says, "Okay." And he walks away and he comes back with a cup, puts it down. I'm looking out at the audience, absolutely no expression. And suddenly a girl walks in. And nobody else was in this coffee shop, just me. And she walks in and sits next to me and looks out at the audience. And of course I notice her, I glance to the right. And I remember, automatically I do it. See, I glance to my right and she's looking at her purse or something and paying no attention to me. And the guy comes up there and says, "Excuse me, would you care to see the menu?" She says, "No, I'll have coffee." "It's black, or do you want sugar and cream?" She says, "Black." And he brings her the coffee. Now, at this point, I'm turned slightly to my left. I look away from her now, and I'm looking at a paper, and I'm reading it, and I'm drinking the coffee, see? It's obvious I'm very much aware of her, though. It's a beautiful girl sitting next to me, so I glance, and I'm drinking my coffee. And what I don't see, though, is that she's looking at me absolutely straight on, intently. And suddenly she says, "It won't work." And I say, "Excuse me, are you talking to me?" And at this point, she's turned back to her coffee now, and she's drinking coffee, looking kind of bugged. I look at her, and I go back to my coffee, you know. You know, New York, what the hell? See, so I'm drinking my coffee. Suddenly, she looks up again and looks right at me. And again, I don't see her. See, but the audience does. She says, "It's silly to even pretend that it would work. It will not work." At this point, I turn and I say, "Excuse me, are you talking to me?" She said, "I don't want to discuss it." I says, "Discuss what?" She says, "Us." "Us?" She says, "You and me. It's impossible. No way we can ever get together." I said, "Wait a minute. What's wrong with me?" She says, "It's not you, it's us." So, okay. I go back to my coffee. But now it's bugging me. At which point I turn and I says, "No, wait a minute, you didn't even give me a chance." She says, "It's always the same with you." I said, "What do you mean it's always the same?" She says, "It will not work. It won't work." I think about this and I says, "You know, I think you're right." Leaves. I look out at the audience. The counter man comes on. He says, "You want more coffee?" I says, "Yeah, give me some more." He pours more coffee. A long pause, and I say finally, I said, "You know, I do, I fail. The curtain goes down."
Beautiful.
And that was a fantastic skit. And it was what it was we'd gone through a whole courtship, marriage, divorce, and it's over.
Beautiful.
And he is crushed.
That is very, very lovely.
That was a 1.5-minute skit. It was a real hit. It was a big thing. It was in a show called Smalltacular. And I think it had appeared in another review prior to that. Then there was another one, too. Am I boring you?
No, please, continue.
See, the review, we did another one. That was Dorothy Love. And then there was another one where we were all four of us facing the audience, four people, myself, and there was a girl sitting next to me and a guy sitting back of me, and there was a girl sitting next to him. We're facing the audience, and suddenly you were just looking out at the audience, and we all have this look of a curious look of a vague mask-like trepidation. Just, we're not really scared, but we're just sort of grim. And the voice says,
"Are you please fasten your seatbelts? We'll be landing at LaGuardia in about maybe 2.5 minutes.
Whatever it is. We're in the airplane." And at that point, I'm sitting there looking, trying to look suave, and I put the seatbelt on and sitting looking out. And I'm looking out over Queens, and the girl is looking out over Queens, see? And suddenly the guy behind me leans forward and he says, "Grab her, buddy." And I pay no attention. See, I'm looking out. I'm looking out of the Queens. And the girl leans forward and says to Dorothy, "This guy's never going to make a pass. If you're going to get anywhere with him, you better make the first move." And she pays no attention. She just keeps looking out. And next, I'm looking, all of a sudden, something roars. They're putting the flaps down. And the guy behind me leans forward and says, "My God, we're going to crash. We're all going to be dead. We're going to die. This is it." I look absolutely enigmatic. I never say a word. I just sort of look. And at that minute, the girl's behind Dorothy leans forward and says, "What was that noise? I think we're going to crash. We're going down." And she turns to me and says, "Excuse me, do you have the time?" And I say, "Did you speak to me?" She says, "Yes, do you have the time?" Well, yes, it's 3:10. And the girl behind her immediately says, "Quick now, make your move." And what the audience now begins to see is that this is our inner selves behind us. It's not at all us. And he's playing very well. He says, "There's nothing to fear, you know. I'm flying. I used to be a jet pilot." And, and this guy keeps going, look out, she may know something about flying. Don't hold it. So I used to be a jet pilot, you know. They're putting down the flammable stairs, no problem at all. It's just a normal routine. All of a sudden, you hear another thing. She said, What was that? He's just my. He goes, "This is it. You're going to die in a minute now. You might as well. It's all over. I told you not to take this damn trip." He went back and all the way down, and they finally land, and they get up, and now the two people have disappeared completely.
You mean the inner thoughts?
The inner thoughts are gone, and right. She takes her coat and leaves. He takes his coat, and they leave, and they never make it. It's just one of those brief, momentary things.
Brief encounters.
Yeah, it was a beautiful written sketch. But that's the kind of reviews that they used to have here in town. And it's not that long ago, 65, 66. Mm-hmm. And all kinds of little psychological vignettes. And that was in a review called Smalltacular. I wonder if anybody listening saw it.
Well, we're going to take some calls in just a moment, and we'll find out if we have some listeners that remember some of those things that we've been talking about with
Gene Shepherd. My name, Long John Neville.
I'm Candy Jones.
And we are back here again. We're going to be taking calls on 489-1155, 489-1155. Gene Shepherd's new book, or I should say his hardcover book that was on the bestsellers list for some 17 weeks, is titled Wanda Hickey's Night of Golden Memories and Other Disasters. And it's published by Dell. It's in paperback now, and you've been listening to Gene, so you can imagine how great the book is after listening to Gene all night long. He's a great, great storyteller. In fact, he was 4-time winner of the Playboy Humor and Satire Award. Gene and I worked together at WOR for a number of years, I guess. We were there about 10 years together, and Gene has always been a very good friend, and every time he has the time to spare, we invite him on to the show because we feel that you'll get a great kick out of hearing Gene Shepherd. I would also like to remind you that on Saturday night, Cy Oliver will be with us, arranger, composer, musician, and orchestra leader who is now appearing at the Royal Box. And you better call Ed Wynn and make reservations, because when Cy Oliver appears any place, they're going to be jammed. And we'll also have Jack Riley, who teaches jazz piano at the New School, and Donald Bain, former friend of mine, who is now an acquaintance. He's an author and a very fine musician, plays vibes, drums, and a small amount of piano. And he's a very talented man, a great writer, and he has done the biography of Long John Neville. I've had an opportunity of reading the manuscript, and that's why he is an acquaintance, no longer a friend. It's to be published by Macmillan in September, and I think September is the publication date. And this is not a commercial, because if you don't buy it, it's just as well. I don't think you'll find it to be too interesting, although the people that have read it... Incidentally, the man who wrote the introduction for it, Jackie Gleason. Jackie Gleason called Macmillan and said he'd like to write the introduction. He had read that a book was being written about Long John Neville, and I'm very proud of that. I've had an opportunity of reading it. It's an 8-page introduction, and it's a beautiful introduction. I would have hoped that he would have saved it for the eulogy, and we don't know when that's going to come about, so he couldn't wait, and he wanted to write it and get it across.
I've always admired Jackie Gleason, by the way.
Great talent. Great, great,
fascinating guy. He used to call late at night at the station.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's Jackie. Friday night, we're going to be talking with Leonard Sloan of the business news staff of the New York Times about the great merchants, the people who built America's foremost retail institutions, department stores, discount houses, mail order houses, supermarkets, and how they did it. And on Sunday night, Dr. Cyril Weck. He and Dr. Noguchi performed the autopsy on Senator Robert Kennedy. And also Dr. Cyril H. Weck, the forensic pathologist, had the opportunity of going through the archives that contained the material from the autopsy that was done on John F. Kennedy. And he feels that it was a conspiracy. It was not Oswald alone by any means, shape, or form. Now, that's his opinion. We'll also have Alan Cornett with us. And so we've got some good shows in store for you, and we hope that you'll tell your friends and neighbors about them. And I was hoping that Candy would be back by now. She just stepped out of the studio for a couple of minutes, so that she could hear the difference between the high school horses and the Liberty horses. So I think we'll have to take our first call right now. And let's put this equipment on. You've got the cans there for just a moment. I hope that our first listener will be patient, because
I forgot to prepare myself by getting this ready, and we'll try to get it ready to
everything plugged in here.
Can, yeah. And so we'll take these calls on 489-1155, 489-1155. All right. Hello.
That's been bothering me for the last hour or so. The difference, really, between a high school horse and a Liberty horse is that the high school horse will perform with a rider on it.
Yes.
And the rider will cue it for these various fancy steps or maneuvers.
Mm-hmm.
The Liberty horse performs alone, in other words, without a rider. They'll come in groups of six or eight.
Mm-hmm.
And the trainer will work the whole act from the center of the ring. The horses are cued by the whip or by his voice.
Mm-hmm.
To turn and wheel and reel up and do these things.
Mm-hmm. Are you a horsewoman?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yes, like a horse freak.
May I ask you a question? What about those horses that Candy mentioned on the island off of Virginia?
Well, they're ponies. They're ponies, actually.
Then what's the difference between a pony and a horse?
That is open to a lot of argument. Anything smaller than 14-2 is called a pony.
14 hands, two something. What's the two?
2 inches. Hand is four.
Well, what are they called?
They live on the island of Assateague.
Uh-huh.
But they're actually called Chincoteague ponies.
What are they called?
Chincoteague ponies.
Chincoteague.
Mm-hmm. And uh-huh. They send them over to Chincoteague once a year. I think they sell the parts, and then they turn the adults back.
Mm-hmm.
They're good, when you get them young enough, they're very good kids ponies. They're very tiny.
How many of them are on this island?
See, I don't know. I really don't. Not all that many, though.
They're so beautiful, aren't they?
Oh, no. Yeah, they're protected by the government.
Well, it's good to hear that there are some horse people out there, right, John?
Yes, and did you hear it, Candy?
Candy did hear it. She was in one of the other studios for a moment, so she heard the comment. Well, we thank you very, very much. Have you ever heard Mr. Shepherd prior to tonight?
Oh, yeah. Quite a lot.
Do you think he's a talented man?
I certainly do.
He's a good rider,
too.
What's that?
He's a good rider.
Is he really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he really is. He knows what he's doing. I've seen him ride. He's got more out of a horse. I don't mean abuse it, but I mean really, really make it work.
Well, I hit him on the head with a hammer.
Don't. You have a tendency to do everything at a dead run, but the horse seems to enjoy it.
Well, thanks for calling, Lee.
Thank you. Is this Lee?
That's Lee.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Good show. Great show. I'm really enjoying it.
Well, thank you very much. This is Gene Shepherd's producer who we're talking to. And did you have a question or anything to ask, Candy?
No. Hello, Lee. I was listening to you.
Let me get over to your seat. Go ahead.
Okay.
Wait a moment, Lee.
Candy's
coming back.
You heard those heavy hoofs. Wait till I just put my ear things in. Hi there.
Hi, how
are Brian, I was listening to you. I was in the newsroom because at this time I always go in to pick up the weather report, as a matter of fact, and I was very interested in what you had to say. And what was the name of the island? I know you said it begins with C, and I still can't put
it to.
Ah, that's it.
I hope I'm pronouncing it right. If not, you'll get a call.
I'm sure we will.
Okay.
Well, we've heard very good things about you.
Thanks.
And I'm glad to know the difference between the two types of horses.
Okay.
Thanks
very much, Lee.
Okay. So long, Lee.
Okay. Bye-bye. Hi there. You're on the air.
John.
Yes, sir.
I like to see you.
Yes, go right ahead. Gene is listening.
I like to take a flight up, day after tomorrow. And I've flown 5 times, and I am so scared. But, anyway, you've flown all over the country. I'm Candy. You ever get any fears?
Well, I'm a pilot myself, and I own an airplane. So I would not be one to tell you about fears, but don't worry about it. You statistically, you're far safer in an airplane than you are in a car, believe it or not. But for every mile flown, let's put it this way, mile for mile, you're far safer in an airplane than you are in a car.
Well, I live by Kennedy Airport. I come over all the time.
Well, yeah, but...
they never come down.
No, don't worry about it. Just go in there and sit down and order your drink, and the next thing you know, you're going to be in Oshkosh.
Okay, I'll take it.
Thank you, sir. Nice to talk to you. Candy, do you want to take some?
killing.
All right.
Harlow Wilcox.
Harlow Wilcox?
You remember that name?
Yeah, the name,
He was an announcer, and I don't know why, it just suddenly...
Well, when did you think of him?
Well, because my real name was Wilcox, and Pierre André and André Baruch, and I'm flipping back about 3 or 4 hours ago when we had been talking about Little Orphan Annie Society, and the famed announcers of that period, Truman Bradley.
Vincent Pelletier.
Yes, yeah.
Hey, is there anybody else out there? Now, what are you doing? You plugging in the thing
I'm
there? Yeah, here we go.
In.
Okay,
here
let's see
go.
If there's an audience there.
Good morning, you're on WMCA.
Good morning, Candy.
Hi.
Good morning, John, and good morning, Judy.
Hi.
Thank you ever so much for three of you for the most riveting and enjoyable program. I hope you save this tape and play it, you know, over and over again, maybe on a couple of Sunday evenings. Absolutely marvelous.
I know we will play it again.
Yes. I have followed this talented wild man, Gene Shepherd, long before John came on the air. And what a WOR, they're having such these time schedules, you know, and John moving about, and you, Candy, have been joining the group. It's getting better year by year.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
And thank you ever so much.
And thank you for calling.
Enormously.
Thank you. The temperature, by the way, 38 degrees, humidity 70%, barometer 29.97 inches and falling. The wind south at a gentle 6 miles per hour, and the wind and the weather in Central Park is quite fair. We'll take another call. Good morning, you're on WMCA.
Hey, Candy, how do you like married life without sex?
Good morning, you're on WMCA. Hello, 489-1155. Good morning.
Good morning. Is this WMCA?
Yes, it is. You're on the air.
Sorry. Ms. Jones?
Yes.
And Mr. Neville, I wanted to let you know that I am a Harlow Wilcox fan, too.
Very good.
And just recently, the Fibber McGee and Molly show, which is the one thing I know he used to do, is broadcast over WRVR. On their Festival of Old Radio. Sometimes it's on Tuesday, sometimes on Thursday.
Oh.
And the recordings come through as if it were just the original. They give different commercials.
Well, that's very interesting. I thank you very much for calling.
No Johnson's Wax. They're current commercials, but the show is exactly the same.
I see.
Enjoy your show.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye. Good morning. You're on WMCA.
Good morning, Candy.
Good morning.
Yes,
he is. Go right ahead.
I want to say to Shepherd, Excelsior.
Well, I can only say seltzer bottle, baby.
I want to know where to get your record.
Now, there are several records I've had. The most recent is a Mercury recording.
Mercury.
Called The Declassified Gene Shepherd. And the only place that I know that they had it recently was at the King Carol Record Shop on the... Right there in Times Square.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did you play another record?
Yeah, I probably the most successful record I had was the one called Will Failure Spoil Gene Shepherd.
Oh.
And that was cut by Elektra, released by Elektra Records.
Elektra.
And I'm not sure that you can get that.
I see. I wrote to Mercury about the other one, and I get no response.
Well, that's Mercury, yes. That's
now,
typical.
Now, tell me this. Are your sketches for sale anywhere?
My sketches? Well, the only place that my drawings are really for sale, I guess, are in The Ferrari in the Bedroom, the most recent book that I had. Which
yeah,
had.
They're great.
You like the sketches?
Oh, they're great.
Well, you know, it's funny. Very few critics even mention them, and that kind of bothered me because I spent a lot of time doing them.
I would think so.
Adam, we happen to have one. We have one framed on the wall of the plaza.
Yeah.
So lucky.
Yeah.
I bought so many of the books for my nephews in college, and they're all crazy about the sketches.
Now. Well, thank you. I really appreciate that because as a drawer, and I've been drawing all my life, I used to do a lot of those drawings, by the way, originally appeared in the Village Voice. I did at one time a lot of drawings for the Village Voice, and I've done some illustrations.
Yeah. Oh, they're really fine.
Well, thank you very
much. Thank you very much for
calling. All right, let me tell Long John that I still have the sheep's eggs. Oh,
good. Well, I'll certainly tell him that. Thank you for telling us. Thank you. It's 4:52 in the morning.
Sure is.
Good morning. You're on WMCA. Gene Shepherd is right here.
Hello, Candy.
Yes.
How are you?
Well, thank you.
Is this the lady who sent you the flowers and leaves?
Oh, how very nice of you. I hope that you...
I tell you, some friends of mine called me and told me that you spoke about it. I'm sorry I didn't hear it.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, we did. And I again thank you so kindly for your very beautiful bouquet.
That's all right. I just want to tell you, I've been laughing all night. I think the show is so terrific. I just had to...
Well, you tell that to Gene Shepherd. He's listening to you.
I know. He's very nice. I've been listening, used to listen to him quite a long time.
Well, and I think that you certainly will want to get a copy of his latest paperback, Wanda Hickey's Night of Golden Memories and Other Disasters. You know, it's published by Dell.
Yes, I will.
Just out. I'm sure you'll like it.
Is Long John there?
He's out of the studio at the moment. He'll be coming back soon.
Well, tell him that... Hattie said hello.
I certainly will.
Okay, good night, Kate.
Good night, thank you. Good morning, you're on WMCA.
Good morning, Candy. I'd like to speak to Gene Shepherd, please.
Speaking.
Hi.
Hi.
Been a fan of yours for years.
Well,
you know those skits that you were talking about?
Yeah.
I think I saw them on television within the past 2 years. Did you say they were written by Woody Allen?
No, I did not say that.
Oh, I thought you did. I know you said that you were with him.
No, I said that Woody Allen had written some of the sketches that were in this review, but he didn't write those two. Not those.
Yeah. I don't know where I could swear I saw them.
Well, maybe you saw the review that I was in. I don't recall it.
No, I don't think so. This is a had them seated in an airplane.
Well, there's been a lot of sketches written about airplanes.
Well, it seems to be the exact same wording. Look, there's something I want to ask you.
Yeah.
You used to talk about war meadows.
No, I didn't. I've never... Where did you get that?
Didn't you even write about them in God Be Trust?
No.
I swear you did when you were talking about the little candies.
Well, okay, thank you very much for calling.
You.
Well,
good morning, you're on WMCA.
Remember
me,
don't you?
Hello.
You're on the air. Yeah, you're on the air.
Did anybody call up to give the name of Bud Freeman?
I thought of it later. It was Bud Freeman. That's who we were talking about. You're right, sir.
Also, as a long-time saxophone player, may I be allowed to correct you on something? I see melody and a soprano sax.
Are two different saxophones.
Right.
You're right.
The C melody is in between the alto and tenor.
And the most difficult to keep in tune.
The C melody is difficult to keep in tune because it is really a bastard saxophone to begin with.
That's what we meant.
And the...
You just put it more bluntly.
And so is the soprano.
The current soprano is the one that's really terrible.
Well, that's what Wilbert plays.
Yeah, right. That one is impossible.
And that's what Bechet played, too.
No, Bechet played the state.
No, he also played the...
He played the curve.
That's right, because the man who owns it today is Wilbert.
Yeah, right. That soprano is at least 45 years old.
And it's even a terrible instrument to listen to.
Well, no one has done... Very few people have ever done it well.
That's true.
Hodges, Bechet,
it's like the bagpipes.
Yeah, right. You could name it on one hand. The people have been able to play that thing.
Did you hear Gene do the head thumping?
Yeah. I've listened to his head thumping for 20 years.
Well, you got to admit, I got a beat, man.
Yeah. Your head thumping has come along for years.
That's right. We artists mature.
That's what oils. All the credit goes to. Thank you.
Okay. F-A-E-M-A-R-T. Famart. That's the word. That's the name. And Famart is convenient. International cooker. Buy wherever.
Well, you've heard the discussion. My name, Long John Neville.